JSA in the 90s. This episode, Justice Society of America number 9, cover dated April 1993. Hello, and welcome to JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. We are a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. My name's Iridium Shag, and I'm your host, but I'm not flying solo. Every single episode, we feature a different guest host. My co-host today opened an online store in the year 2007, trying to sell his 9 boxes of comics. 6 years later, he closed the store, finding himself now owning 15 boxes of comics, thanks to listening to podcasts. Either he's very bad at math, or us podcasters are a bad influence. I'll let you folks decide. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. Devin Clancy. Welcome to the JSA Brownstorm, Devin. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
I'm doing great. You're bringing me back to my freshman year of college in April 1993. I don't necessarily remember that entire year, so this is really good to be reminded of some stuff.
I started looking at the dates. I'm like, oh my gosh, April 93. Like, so much was going on in my life at that point that I probably don't want to remember. I was a junior in college at that point, probably, or sophomore, somewhere in that range. And woof. Anyway, but let's just leave that behind us. So it's good to talk to you, man. So last time we talked about Justice League International. And before that, we talked about V. So I'm thrilled to have you here.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know if it's a spoiler, but last time you gave me kind of a really terrible issue of Justice League International. So I think you made up for it now. I'm just going to say.
I'm very excited to say that. Now, before that, I gave you the entire run of the V comics. So that was pretty sweet. You got to say.
Yeah. I mean, that was cool. It was 18 whole issues for me to talk about at length.
Exactly.
That was a very long podcast, if I remember.
I think each episode was like 4 hours or something. It was crazy. If you like V and you want to do a deep dive, folks, let me know.
I mean, it's like a multi-part miniseries. That's appropriate.
There, exactly. There it is. Well, folks, before we get too far along reminiscing, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. This episode of JSA in the 90s is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders to $50 or more. Now, each episode will select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library. Usually, it's tied into this month's JSA issue in some way, shape, or form. This issue features a battle between Alan Scott and Guy Gardner. And because Guy Gardner's in the issue, I am so excited I got to pick a JLI trade. As I mentioned, Devin and I did an episode of JLI Podcast. If you folks don't know, for 8.5 years, I hosted a podcast all about the Justice League International, the Bwahaha Podcast. And so here is this fantastic collection called Justice League International Book 2, Around the World. And it collects Justice League International, or America, however you want to call it, issues 18 through 30, Justice League Europe 1 through 6, Justice League International Annual number 1. So this is, you know, J.M. DeMatteis and Keith Giffen working with Kevin Maguire, Ty Templeton, Bart Sears, a ton of amazing artists. It's a great collection. And here's the deal. There are two of these out there in stock trades right now, both called Justice League International Book 2. You're going to, if you look for the 2025 version, you're going to pay a little more. This one's, I think, is from 2020. Get the 2020 version because it's cheaper. So this one normally retails for $29.99, and you can get it for 40% off on InStock Trades right now. So it's only $17.99. And I promise you, these are some of the funniest darn comics you're going to read. They are so amazing. I absolutely love these. And I don't even have to ask you, Devin. I know you read these, and I know you love them.
Of course, yeah. I actually have the omnibus that's just impossible to carry around and impossible to read. I mean, I should get this if I'm actually going to, you know, read the stuff again, for sure.
Right. I mean, your hips, you know, once we get to a certain age, they can't even take the weight of those omnibuses sitting on your lap anymore. So, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So, did you happen to bring an InStock Trades pick?
Of course I did. I'm not an animal.
What you got?
So this is going to be in stock trade because it comes out in October, but I noticed your guests have been doing this lately, so I think it's okay. It's DC Finest Events, Crisis on Infinite Earths, Trade Paperback Part 1. And this is in all caps. For the first time ever, experience Crisis on Infinite Earths with all the tie-in issues and crossovers in reading order. And, I mean, I think that's kind of a big deal. I don't know how they figured it out, whatever. I'm sure they have some theories. But that's never happened before. You could pile your comics up, but everyone has their own thing. So this is the official way, I guess.
Interesting.
Yeah, written by, you know, the typical Marv Wolfman, Roy Thomas, Doug Monch. Is that? I don't know how to say that. and art by George Perez, Gene Colan, etc. So, and more, as red skies set across the infinite Earths, worlds will live and worlds will die, and nothing will ever be the same. This collects DC Comics Presents 78, Crisis on Infinite Earths 1-4, All-Star Squadron 50-52, really popular with the listeners of this show.
Mm-hmm.
Fury of Firestorm 41, mm-hmm. I think you're a fan, right?
A little bit.
Yeah. Infinity Inc. 18-19. Detective Comics 555-558, which wasn't actually like bannered as a Crisis crossover, so I guess that's one of those Red Sky things.
Okay.
Green Lantern 194, Justice League of America 244, Batman 389-391, The Loser Special number 1, Wonder Woman 327, and Pages from Swamp Thing number 39. Now, this comes out October 21st, 2025. It will retail at $39.99, but in-stock trades price will possibly be $23, but also I've been seeing that in the first week when a DC Finest comes out, they charge $17.99, if you can believe that. Yeah, so that's 55% off cover price. And I did a little math, and my math could be wrong, but it's actually less per page than if you had bought the original issues off the newsstand.
That's insane! That's incredible!
It's like 2 cents per page, and on the newsstand it'd be like, you know, 22 pages for 75 cents. It's like three and change cents per page. So this is a great deal.
That is a steal, and what an interesting idea to put this, again, in reading order. Like, yeah, some of those Red Skies crossovers, it's got to be like, where do you stick that? In between what issues? And do you stick it in the middle of an issue? I hope they didn't like stick stuff in the middle of Crisis. Like issue 3, you read half of it and then suddenly you're reading Green Lantern. I hope they didn't do that. But still, what an interesting idea to put stuff in reading order. That's really cool. Wow. Okay. So if this is the first 4 issues of Crisis, I'm assuming there's going to be 3 of these books altogether. And the DC Finest is this new line that DC's doing that are really nice. So this should be a heck of a package, man. Great pick.
Yeah, I've already bought all of the DC Finest just because I guess I have a problem, but I've read some of them too, and it's awesome. It's just, you know, great reprint quality, and they're in the right order, and you have like a full, you know, year and a half, depending on the character, of everything that was happening at that time, and it can range from 1938 to 2011, so there's just everything, literally.
I think you just uttered probably the most honest statement anyone's ever said on this podcast, which is, I bought all of them, and I've even read some of them, which is like
exactly
a total collector issue for all of us, I think. We all have bookshelves and bookshelves full of stuff that I'm going to read someday, so... Well, folks, that is an awesome pick. That is absolutely incredible. So again, look for it. It is DC Finest Events, Crisis on Infinite Earths, Trade Paperback Volume 1, and it will be out in October. So for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because, you know, running the Firewater Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with the expenses. So we launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JSA in the 90s podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the Fire and Water Podcast Network. And at certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. Our thanks go out to this all-star squadron of supporters: Alex Osias, Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, Chris Mort, Craig Fletcher, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Ducky, Extremely Uncanny, Gord Tolton, Jason Keen, Jay Campbell, Keechy Baker, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Matt Ev, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Zumkowski, Roger Preeb, Little Russell Burbage, Symbol Pending, Ted Killington, Tim Price, and some weirdo named Devin Clancy. That's right, folks. He paid to be here. Ha ha ha, sucker. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcasts.
Are you saying the previous guests of this podcast didn't pay to be here?
Well, actually, a lot of the names I just read out have been on the show before. Okay. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of 6 and 1, half dozen the other. So,
yeah. Okay. I mean, I feel a little bit better about that, but like, I didn't know.
I mean, it's like a protection racket we got going. So, I mean, it's kind of how it works out. All right, folks. And as I always say, go out on the social medias. We are at JSA Presents on most of the different socials. And it's always about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. Now, Devin, sir, I need to know. I am dying to know. What is your personal origin story with the JSA? How did you discover the team? Why did you fall in love with them? Or is this the first JSA comic you've ever read?
Well, I think I figured out that I kind of like, I always like an alternate version of a well-known character, and that tends to be my favorite. Like, my favorite Star Wars action figure was R5-D4. He's like R2, but a little different. And so it's almost like there's more of an imagination, especially since, I mean, the weird part about that is I had the figure before I really saw the movie. Like, I didn't really know what his role was in the story, you know, until I got like a storybook and everything like that. But you couldn't just, you know, watch Star Wars like you can. It was like more about the imagination of a slightly different character. Like, I kind of sort of feel the same way about like Supergirl is like a slightly different version of Superman, a little bit more interested in her at that age. And then once I started getting into comics around 1985, one of my first mainstream DC books was DC Comics Presents 86, which was a Superman Supergirl crossover and also a Crisis thing. And so eventually, somehow, I don't know exactly how, because it wasn't right away, that led me to Crisis number 7, which has two Supermen, or Supermans, or whatever. And in that book, Harbinger does about 5 pages of exposition that just explains everything. The DC multiverse, like where it came from, what's at stake, and all this stuff. And there's all these characters just sort of standing around with, they don't really identify all of them. They do some. Like they say, oh, this is Superman of Earth 2, and then they get to Blue Beetle, and he's like, enough already, we're bored with this. So she didn't get to identify everyone, but like I was hooked because I was 11. So naturally I'm like, oh, I want to know more about this. So there was the old Superman, and then there was a weird looking Green Lantern, which was Alan Scott. I mean, like I knew Firestorm from TV and I know exactly who else was there, but there were very few characters I actually knew, but I knew that Green Lantern existed and this was not the same guy. I picked up the rest of Crisis and, you know, obviously learned a lot more, and they did Secret Origins, and I was also getting Who's Who. I think you mentioned the Power Girl entry on your recent Who's Who rehash show.
Yeah.
And I definitely remember waiting for that one to, like, just find out more about this, like, sort of Supergirl clone. Didn't really know. Had a different costume and everything. So it was all pretty interesting to me. And then at some point in the, you know, soon after that, Last Days of the JSA came out, 68 pages, no ads. And it was like $250. I don't know why I just had that kind of money lying around at that time. But I was like, this is my first chance to actually read about these characters. And, you know, of course, they're gone at the end. And sort of, but, you know, it seemed like kind of a nice ending for them if they had to be gone. And you learned about them throughout. So I, you know, was, you know, reading about them for kind of the first time. For some reason, they were putting the JSA out to pasture. And I was like, well, I can, you know, check out All-Star Squadron and Infinity Inc. I can get maybe some back issues and stuff. But the main cast of those books, it was kind of like their own characters and not the, like, you know, the other versions of Hawkman or Green Lantern or Flash or, you know, Superman wasn't in it that much, at least not in the issues I had. It was kind of like a little bit disappointing, even though, you know, I grew to kind of like All-Star Squadron as well. But it was disappointing that you didn't have, like, the Golden Age versions of all these characters available to you.
All right. They weren't. I used to see the same thing all the time. I'd pick it up and I'd be like, ooh, you know, I'm going to go see Hourman. Oh, no, I'm not. I'm going to spend a lot of time with Robot Man this time. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. That was kind of how I felt, because I started buying it with the Crisis crossovers. I, you know, dipped into some back issues and then followed it until it petered out. And then Young All-Stars, I was like, well, I don't know who any of these guys are. Like, okay. So the time I was into comics from like 1985 through 1992 or 3, or when I was in, you know, around when this book came out, I was the worst time to be a JSA fan because there was almost nothing.
Right.
But there was other things that did come out that were kind of interesting. Like there was the Crisis Index, which maybe the source of that actual reading order thing we were just talking about.
Ah.
It told you where every character was, where they came from, what their origin was, and every single time they had appeared in anything. So you could just look it up and you could find out, oh, there was all these JLA, JSA crossovers. That sounds cool. I can't afford those. So I guess I'll never read them. So, I mean, the JSA was off the table for most of the part because, you know, I was into comics in late 80s, early 90s, and up until this series. I mean, you know, I could have bought Armageddon Inferno, but I didn't because who knew that the JSA was going to show up in it, right?
And you probably were a man of taste, so that's why you didn't buy it.
Yeah.
So.
I had read the previous Alien whatever, and I was like, eh.
Right, no, exactly. Exactly. You know, you read Alien Agenda or whatever it was, and it's like, eh, I'm good. Thanks.
Yeah. So as a person interested in the JSA, I had, you know, the Golden Age Secret Origins issues, which were cool. I had the Power Girl miniseries, which had nothing to do with the original Power Girl, really. And then what I eventually got interested in was kind of the way they were weaving the history of the JSA back into the unified universe. So I think of them more as the past of the current universe as opposed to the Earth 2 versions. Like, I don't really have a a strong connection to the Earth 2 stories, you know, where they kind of cross over universes kind of constantly. So anyway, so I got off to college in 1992, and like I closed up my pull list at home and went off to school. I came back in November, and the comic store I had been shopping at was completely out of business. So I guess I had been supporting them or something. But the store I would frequent in Washington, D.C. didn't have as much stuff, and they didn't get everything. And so kind of drifted off from comics. I wasn't totally into it. And so I was like, well, I'm going to just cut it off at this point. And so I go to the comic book store to close the pull box I had there. And I see, oh, Death of Superman is coming. Doomsday is, you know, 2 months away. I'm like, okay, well, I'll make that the end of it. But I'm only going to buy the Superman books. I won't really pick up the, you know, the new JSA book that I was aware of. But I didn't pick it up. It was this book. I think I got the first issue, and that was probably it. Because I was just out of money. I was like, you know, 18 years old. I had worked the previous summer. And then so I was like, oh, well, being at college as a kid is kind of expensive.
Absolutely. I totally can get that.
Yeah. That was like the end of comics for me for a while. Around 2006, I sort of got sucked back into it. I was looking through like my old stuff I had hanging around because my mom said, just take this out of my house, please. And so I was looking through it. I was like, oh, that's this cool. I've got the Justice League International. I'd like to read that again. I wonder what, you know, they're doing with these characters now. And of course, they had the Justice Society of America book was just starting up again, like the Geoff Johns version.
Oh, yeah.
And so I started reading that and got totally sucked back in. It was like, I'm just a comic person again. And, you know, I start listening to podcasts and people are basically enabling me. And so there you go.
I don't know that I've heard that term, us as enablers, but I'll own it. I'll own it. That's fair. That's fair. So have you gone back and read the stuff you missed, like the Geoff Johns JSA series before Justice Society of America, but the JSA when it was like 1999 to 2005 or whatever?
I definitely picked up the majority of trades and I read them and ended up selling them when we had my first son 12 years ago. We lived in a 2-bedroom condo and I was like, I got to get rid of these comics. I can probably get them digitally in some way or in the future or whatever. So I'll sell all the physical books. So I definitely read them and then enjoyed them and everything like that. But they're not as hugely impactful for me as the formative years of the 80s and the early 90s and stuff like that.
I totally get it. I just I'm looking forward to us covering those soon. So I just was curious if you'd read them because I think they're great. So awesome.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed them for sure. I just like I don't have an encyclopedic memory of them the way I do with like, say, the John Byrne Superman era kind of thing.
Sure. No. Well, I'm glad so much of your origin was so fun because like the Crisis Index issues, I haven't thought of those things for years. They're sitting right on my shelf right next to my Crisis hardcover, but I hadn't thought about cracking them open and looking at those things in years. And I think I need to do that because they're just fun to look at and dive through. For me, sort of similar to you, as far as like looking at back issues and going, I can't buy that stuff. I used to use, there was the Loose Leaf Who's Who that came out in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And then Mayfair Games published a supplement to go with it. And in the Mayfair Games supplements that would go with the Loose Leaf Who's Who, like you'd get a Loose Leaf role-playing supplement. You put that right next to the other one. Anyway, in the back, they listed every appearance of that character. And I mean every appearance. If they were in the background and all one color and weren't even colored, it's listed there. And so I would look at those, especially ones like, you know, Alan Scott or Jay Garrick, and just miles and miles of various appearances. And be like, oh my gosh, I didn't know they were in this comic and this comic and this comic. And like you, I was like, I'm never going to be able to afford to touch any of those. Okay. And I probably wouldn't be allowed to be in the same room as those comics.
Absolutely.
Oh, the days before the internet, Devin. The internet.
You reminded me the other way that I absorbed DC Comics history was the original Mayfair games. I had the box, and I had zero people to play it with, so I just read it and looked at it and played with the little cards and stuff. And so that's, I think they didn't really focus too much on the Earth 2 characters at that point, but that's how I learned about like Teen Titans and Legion and Justice League and all that stuff. It was like, you know, the really cool box cover art and then all the drawings of the characters and stuff.
Actually, if I can, Mayfair Games published an amazing source book called The World at War. And it was a Mayfair Games DC Heroes supplement. And it came out in 1991. And it does cover all of the Justice Society characters as they appeared in World War II. And it is an incredible resource. And folks, if you've never seen it, I recommend you pick it up. It might be relevant to this podcast in the very near future. So let's just leave it at that. But The World at War from Mayfair Games is an incredible book. And that was another, like you, I learned so much DC history, especially World War II history. Because a lot of times you'd read an entry on a character, like a Who's Who or something, and they might spend a minute on the World War II, and then they jump to present day. This was set in World War II, so you learn about the character during the World War II era. Anyway, the Mayfair game stuff, man, just I love those books so much.
Yeah, I didn't even know that one existed. I didn't know they were still making them at that point, but like I remember seeing a handful of the modules and stuff, but you know, none of my friends cared, so I was like, well, I mean, I could read that, but.
Right.
We ended up playing much more Star Wars RPG later in the 80s and 90s.
Oh, the West End Games game was so stinking good. Oh, this is about to turn into a role-playing game podcast if I'm not careful here, because I played the West End game one for years. I love it so much. Okay, all right, enough of that. We're going to stop right now. So instead, we're going to tackle this. You know what? Forget our topic. Let's talk role-playing. No, never mind. We do have a discussion topic where Devin and I thought up an idea. Since in this issue, we get Alan Scott, you know, sort of dealing with his quote-unquote legacy, if you will, Guy Gardner, you know, another Green Lantern. We thought, what if we were to suggest a favorite, or maybe a few, team-ups of different JSA members and their legacy hero? Again, like Alan and Guy, or Jay Garrick and Barry Allen, or Al Pratt and Ray Palmer, or whatever. We each picked three, so we're going to shoot through these. And folks, what I want from you at home is, in the comments, share your favorite a JSA character interacting with their legacy of the same name. So, Devin, why don't you take us first through the first one?
You said we each picked three, but I cheated and I picked five, technically.
Oh, okay.
But I'm paying to be here. We've already established that, so I can do whatever I want.
That is true. That is true.
So I always liked in the early post-crisis when they'd sort of retell like a famous story, but they tell like the post-crisis version where the world was always combined and everything like that. And there was no visiting other universes and stuff like that. And so they'd kind of like redo it like, oh, this is how everyone remembers it happening now. Which, if you think about it, is like kind of like scary that your memory was changed at some point.
Sure. Like, absolutely.
A little bit horrifying. One of them I picked was Secret Origins number 50. This is Grant Morrison's post-crisis retelling of Flash number 123, Flash of Two Worlds. I guess you should expect this, but it's somehow like weirder than the original Silver Age story.
Wait, something written by Grant Morrison that's weird? How?
Yeah, I mean, this is what you should expect. But it is drawn by Mike Parabek, so huge connection right there. Mm-hmm. So just like in the original story, Barry Allen is showing off for kids, and he vibrates himself to a different frequency and disappears. And in this case, instead of going to Earth 2, he just discovers that Keystone City is across the bay, and it's been there like all these years, but hidden. And so he tracks down Jay, who's like in a trance, and they fight the Fiddler, the Thinker, and the Shade, and those are the guys who have actually captured the city and vibrated it to a weird frequency where no one can see it, and also it erased everyone's memories. So, you know, obviously they defeat the villains just like in the original, and everyone from Keystone City comes back, and it ends in some this sort of like Berlin Wall thing where everyone's like greeting people they haven't seen in so many years, and it makes it like, when you think about it too hard, like kind of sad. A little bit tragic.
Wow.
That these people had so much of their lives stolen from them, and like somehow people had memories of like the JSA and everything, but no Flash. So, it begs a bunch of questions. But then actually the story is being told by a little kid, and it's actually being told by Garfield Logan, who becomes Beast Boy and Changeling. And for some reason, I didn't know he grew up in Central City, but he was there, and he's actually writing it as like an essay for school over what happened. So you could say, well, that's not exactly how it happened. That's just what the kid thought.
It's an absolutely wonderful retelling. I adore it. I reread it recently when we did the Jay Garrick Spotlight episode of this show. So I reread it for that, and it's such a joyful story. And you're right. You get the unreliable narrator could easily hand wave anything you don't like in it. And it's super fun. And I'm also a post-crisis baby. So for me, I love finding when they retell a pre-crisis story and figure out how to make it work in the post-crisis universe. Just brings me so much joy. And that one is awesome. That is a great, great, great pick. Good job. I love it.
And the best part is it includes the Fiddler's Fiddler Mobile, which is like a car shaped like a violin, which of course, that's what you'd have, right?
Well, and drawn by Parabek? Yes, please. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Even better.
Absolutely. And for some reason, Secret Origins 50 is not on DC Infinite, but there's a trade paperback that is, which has this story in it, so you can find it.
It's so irritating that that's not there. I think it has something to do with one of the writers, but who went to jail, but now is out of jail. But they've loaded all that person's other stuff, so I don't understand why that one's not there. It's very strange. But, meaning on DC Infinite, I should say. Mm-hmm. So my pick, I decided to steer more towards the tenet of the show. So I steered in the 90s and 2000s for this purposes, because I like the more obscure stuff anyway. So I went, my first pick is Green Lantern number 140. So this is from the year 2001, written by Judd Winnick with art by Daryl Banks. This is a Kyle Rayner and Alan Scott story where they're together. And the story starts with Kyle Rayner. He's having some trouble with his power ring. So him and Alan Scott, they like go out to coffee, and they're just talking, and he's getting advice. It's a very talky issue, which I love. There's some fun antics. There's some super awkward moments, which are great and hysterical. Because in the comic, you know, Kyle and Alan are together. But at this point, Kyle's dating Alan's daughter, Jade. So there's a lot of awkwardness of, like, you know, whenever Jade gets brought up and, like, you know, it's his daughter, fun stuff there. Anyway, in the back half of the issue is Kyle and Alan sparring, which makes it a really fun read all the way around. So it's a definite feel-good issue. There's no true bad guy in it. It's just really great interaction. And you do get a good fight between Alan and Kyle sparring. And it's a good showcase for Kyle and Alan's relationship, both as Green Lanterns, sort of as contemporaries, but not really, because there's a legacy there. And you throw in the factor of, like, you know, this guy, I'm dating his daughter. So it's a really fun issue. Green Lantern 140 from 2001. I hadn't read it in years, but in doing the research for this episode, I just started digging and really found this to be a very fun issue.
I definitely have to check that out, because I've read early Kyle Rayner, but not everything. And those trades were, like, out of print and really expensive for a while, so... I mean, I think at some point they'll put them out again, or you can get them on DC Infinite or whatever, but I'm really interested in that era for sure.
And I would say, if you struggle with it, reading it, because sometimes I've heard people say they struggle with the Kyle era, just, I love the Ron Mars and Daryl Banks era, but if you need to, just jump ahead to the John Winnick era, because mm-hmm. the John Winnick era, in some ways, is possibly better. You could argue either case, but I mean, it's a really good run, so we're checking out.
Cool. I actually sort of have, I don't know if it's a sequel to or a follow-up to that issue, but the next one I picked was DC First, Green Lantern and Green Lantern, which is a post-crisis retelling of Green Lantern number 40, essentially. But the framing story is about Alan Scott, and he's at a dinner. He's being honored, and he's sort of remembering back and telling the story. And then Kyle and Jade are also there, which made me wonder, like, he's with a green girl who's his daughter. Does nobody makes the connection? Like, how does that work?
I feel like she could look not green, I think. Oh, geez. I'm now.
Well, she's drawn as green in the issue, which is why, okay. I was like, well, that's odd. Like, isn't she like an actress or something? I don't know. Anyway. But
good point. Yeah. I mean, if you see her with a guy with black hair and then the guy with the black hair is hanging around with Jade, the Green Lantern, he's kind of easy to, in Alan, you know, easy to put it all together. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, this is him telling the story of one of the first times he worked with Hal Jordan, and it involves Krona. So it's, you know, super important to the universe and the multiverse and all that. It's written by Benjamin Raab, who I've never heard of, R-A-A-B, but he eventually was a writer and producer on The Flash and Arrow.
Now, I'll just add in, he also did the Green Lantern run after Judd Winnick left.
Okay, makes sense. Yeah. Drawn by Pete Woods and Jamal Igel, who I have also heard of. So it tells a similar story to the original, but when Alan first meets Hal, like, he finds, basically the gist of the original is he finds out that his weakness for wood is suddenly gone. So he's like, I'm going to go to Earth One. I'm going to tell Hal, because maybe his yellow thing is also gone. And he goes and they go on adventures and stuff like that. But in this one, he flies across the country to tell him the same thing. And Hal's like, whatever, old man, I don't want anything to do with you. Where in the original, he was like really respectful, like, oh, it's good to see you, my comrade, that kind of thing. So it was an interesting little conflict with them. And then, you know, the same thing kind of happens where Krona takes over the Earth and he's like making everyone hate each other and stuff like that. But in this one, it ends up that Alan kind of saves the world and stops everything. Instead of in the original, it was sort of more of Hal's thing because Alan was mind controlled by Krona. So, and at the end, the other weird thing at the end was that he's like, they're talking about Hal. He's like, yeah, it was, you know, a fun adventure. And Kyle's like, well, yeah, but then he went crazy and kind of lost everything. And Alan says, well, you know, he's the Spectre, so he's still a hero to me. I'm like, really? you forgot about all the murders?
Right.
there's a little bit more character development, both in the flashback and, of course, in the framing story. But the best part, I was looking at the original, and it has one of the coolest editor's notes of all time. So it's this scene where Hal's been knocked out and Krona is inhabiting Alan Scott's body. And he goes, if this entire universe disintegrates due to my experiments, he'll go with it. His ring won't save him then. A little asterisk. And it says, editor's note. True. Green Lantern's ring will protect him only from dangers within the universe, not from the destruction of the universe itself.
That feels like a very important difference in explanation to make, I think.
It's like,
what?
It seems obvious, I guess, but I mean, I guess they're just trying to hype up the danger there. And at this point, they were just talking about, you know, the universe, not the multiverse, which Krona is obviously responsible for, you know, all that stuff. But anyway, so this story was important because it was kind of like the roots of Crisis on Infinite Earths and all that stuff. So interesting to read nowadays.
And I, again, those 1990s retellings of old stories are great. And anything with the Green Lanterns in that era was so much fun. Kyle brought such a fresh energy to it. Okay, I'll just straight up say it. I'm not really a fan of Hal Jordan. I've read a lot of Hal comics over the years. I know there's a lot to like about him. I'm not a huge fan. And so I loved it when Alan or Kyle would get the spotlight. And this sounds like a great opportunity for both of them to sort of interact a bit there. Good stuff. I love it.
Yeah.
All right. My next one is from JSA, which is that series I mentioned earlier, the one from the 1990s, or 1999 to like 2005. So this is issues 48 and 49. They're published in the year 2003. They're written by Jeff Johns and David S. Goyer, and with art by Leonard Kirk and Keith Champagne. And what this is the then Dr. Fate, which is Hector Hall, getting a chance to interact with his predecessor. So this is cool. So Hector Hall gets defeated by Mordru. And as he's Dr. Fate, he ends up getting trapped in Dr. Fate's amulet, you know, as you do. And while he's in there, Hector gets a chance to meet both Kent and Enza Nelson. He meets Jared Stevens, and he gets to meet Eric and Linda Strauss, and they're all in like this farmhouse. It's like it was wonderful, like farmhouse, you know, barbecue where they're like cooking. You know, Kent's got like a apron on, and he's cooking on the grill, and like there's dogs running around the yard and kids, and it's just like this very suburban kind of setting, and it's just weird to see all these superhero people. I mean, most of are playing clothes other than Hector, and they're all just hanging out talking. So there's a lot of fun interactions there, a lot of neat stuff where Hector's getting advice from his predecessors. Now, in the end, of course, it turns out it's really Naboo creating an illusion of those people. They weren't really there because they're all dead at this point, I guess. But it was fun for a couple of issues to see Hector like taking pointers from Enza Nelson and Jared Stevens, because Jared's just a jerk if you don't know the character Jared Stevens, the guy who played Fate. So it was a fun story because I was a big fan of Hector Hall as Dr. Fate. I really liked that incarnation. And I'm also a big fan of Eric and Linda Strauss, and just seeing all of that together brought, and again, in that weird, quirky suburban setting, brought me a lot of joy.
That's awesome. I look forward to this podcast covering it in like 15 years, right?
Well, okay. So I've mentioned this, hinted at it a couple of times. So just so you guys know, when we get to JSA in the 2000s, we're not going to be covering the JSA series one issue at a time. There's no way to do it. I will not live long enough to finish that podcast. And that's not even me like thinking I'm going to die soon. That's just statistically. So instead, when we get to the JSA series, we're actually going to cover it by trade paperback. So we'll be doing it in like roughly 5-issue chunks or so. So I think we'll get through it in a couple of years, plus then all the spotlight issues and stuff. We'll have lots to talk about. Don't worry. We're not going to run out for any time soon. But yeah, we're not going to go issue by issue because I couldn't possibly do it.
Very appropriate for the early 2000s.
That's right. Writing for the trade.
You're writing your podcast for the trade.
Exactly right. All right. What you got next?
Okay. So this is a little bit of a throwback. Like I said, I found out about all these crazy issues from the past and I couldn't afford most of them. But I could afford DC Comics Presents Annual Number 1 from 1982. Now, this is a team-up between Earth 1 Superman, Earth 2 Superman, and Earth 3 Luthor. And they fight two Luthors and Ultraman of Earth 3. So this is Crisis on Three Earths by Marv Wolfman and Rich Buckler. And, you know, the story goes that Marv wanted to do Crisis because he thought it was the multiverse was too confusing for kids. And in my imagination, someone said, "Hey, Marv, the multiverse isn't that bad. It's not that confusing." And he goes, "Oh, yeah, hold my beer. I'm going to write this crazy story." But despite all that, like, I think I read this when I was, you know, 12 or something like that. Like, I got it. It handles everything really well with three different Earths. There's, you know, it's weird that they're going back and forth and all that. But, like, it explains everything. It supports you along the way and it introduces new characters. And it gives you, like, you know, kind of a nice character piece on a couple of the different, you know, the two Supermen, you know, together and what they share and what they don't share. So basically the plot is Luthor of Earth 1 gets thrown in jail, as he usually does. But that was kind of intentional because he wanted to switch places with Earth 2. And so they swap. And, of course, they look different. So nobody realizes that, you know, this is a supervillain. So they're just let out of their cells. And then they go fight their ops, Superman. Or Superman's? Superman? It's one of those.
All right.
So, of course, that doesn't work because, you know, each Superman is able to, you know, defeat the opposite Luthor with no problem. So they team up and they go to Earth 3 and they recruit Ultraman. Superman, who's the evil Superman. And then on that Earth, Alexander Luthor, who's a good guy, he decides, enough of this. The crime syndicate is going crazy. I'm going to become a superhero. And he's like dating Lois Lane and stuff like that. And so he gets the two Supermen to come to his Earth. And together, they stop the Luthors from merging Earth 1 and Earth 2 together. That sounds kind of familiar, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the Earths are so close to each other, and they're overlapping, and they just pass through harmlessly. Kind of, I see where you're going with this, Marv. I think I see what this is building to. So he created the Luthor character, who's actually the father of the Crisis on Infinite Earths, Alexander Luthor. So anyway, in this story, it's like, you know, it's just a team up, and it's just for fun, and it's for punching and stuff like that. But, you know, the Golden Age Superman is sort of talking to, you know, the Earth One Superman about, like, why he married Lois. And he says, you know, maybe you should try it, and, you know, you should consider, because apparently Superman and Lois were dating at this point, because in the beginning they come back from Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they just have different attitudes about stuff. Like, the Superman of Earth 1 gets kind of, like, mad, and the older Superman's like, oh, whoa, don't take it so personal. It's, you know, he's a supervillain, yes, but it's like, you don't have to get so enraged. Which is funny, because he was a hothead back in the 30s. But
right.
And then the other Luthor from Earth 2 is like, I'm just going to destroy both Earths, and we'll be done with it. And the regular Lex Luthor is like, no, I live on Earth 1, and my sister does, too. He's like, I've never been as bloodthirsty as you. So it's an interesting, like, character contrast, which I, of course, knew nothing about, because who reads Golden Age Lex Luthor stories? But, you know, it was like, it was cool that he found something about each of the characters that was actually different to explore.
That's cool. I like that idea. And I'm glad the Luthor of Earth 1 stood up and said that, because I often, when someone threatens to destroy the Earth, I'm like, dude, that's where I keep my stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I'm glad that, you know, Luthor of Earth 1 had the sense to realize destroying the Earth is not going to go well for anyone.
Well, he did convince him by saying, well, we'll just get your sister off the Earth first and then destroy the Earth. He's like, okay, fine. As long as we get to kill Superman.
Great, Lex. Thanks. Well, thanks, Marv. That didn't sound confusing at all.
It holds together. it shouldn't, but it does.
I must have read it at some point. I have no recollection of that story whatsoever, so I think I need to go back and reread that.
I'm a big fan of all of the annuals of DC Comics Presents, because they're all just crazy giant stories.
That's fun. All right. Well, I picked another bit of an obscure one from 1995. I picked Sandman Midnight Theater. This was a one-shot special written by Neil Gaiman and Matt Wagner and drawn by Teddy Christensen. And this is essentially a crossover between Neil Gaiman's Sandman series and Matt Wagner's Sandman Mystery Theater series. And the thing I like, if you've never read either one of these, like, the thing I like about the Wesley Dodds and Morpheus legacy in the comics is that it's retconned essentially the other way around. Because obviously, you know, Wesley Dodds comes first in publication times, you know, in the 30s, and Morpheus comes around in the 80s. But in Neil Gaiman's Sandman comics, what they explain is that Morpheus is one of the Endless, and he's been around since, like, the dawn of man. And Morpheus is eventually captured by this evil human in the year 1916, and he's locked in a basement for decades. And the universe sort of responds to this, to the Lord of the Dreams being locked up, by affecting other people's dreams, including sending Wesley Dodds these prophetic nightmares, where he needs to go out and solve crimes. And this drives Wesley to act as the mystery man called the Sandman, and he wears a World War I gas mask, which happens to look very similar to Morpheus's helmet. So in Gaiman's Sandman comic, again, Wesley Dodds is sort of the legacy character for Morpheus instead, which works really well. So in this story, Sandman Midnight Theater, so it's 1939, and Wesley Dodds is investigating the suicide of a family friend, and this ends up leading the Sandman to England. And while Wesley's there, he's continuing his investigation, and eventually he finds himself at a huge party for someone named Roderick Burgess. You might know that name if you watch Sandman on TV. And while Wesley's sneaking around investigating at this party, in the cellar of Roderick Burgess's home, Wesley comes across Morpheus, who's been imprisoned in the Lord of Dreams has been imprisoned in Burgess's basement for decades. And there you get a couple of pages where Morpheus sort of acknowledges that Wesley Dodds carries a piece of the Dream Lord himself within him. But sadly, Morpheus knows that there's nothing Wesley can do to free him, so the Dream Lord forces Wesley to forget the meeting. So overall, the actual meeting's only like two pages, but it's a great story, and they are threaded together quite well throughout the whole thing, because, like, Wesley's having dreams about Morpheus throughout the whole story, and it really is a merging of both of their books, again, with, like, Roderick Burgess stuff, and yet Wesley Dodds doing the investigation with Dion, or Diane, or however you want to say her name. It's great stuff, and I'm sure they're going to cover it here on this network eventually in Sandman Slept Here, but it's a fun story, Sandman Midnight Theater from 1995.
That sounds amazing. The Sandman business has been on my list for, you know, 20 years to definitely read that at some point. It's like, it sounds so cool. And like, I really like when comic creators are just interested in picking up pieces and messing around with continuity and history and stuff like that, and finding a way to sort of pull it all together and create something new. There's a few creators out there who are like, oh, I don't care about continuity, I just want to do my own thing. And it's like, no, but this is what's cool about superhero comics, is that there is all that. It's a shared universe, you know?
Exactly. Use the toy box, man. Yeah. It's great. And now, if you've ever read the Sandman comics, I cannot recommend enough the Sandman TV series on Netflix enough. It was so stinking good. My wife and I just watched it recently, just finished season two. It might be the best comic book TV series ever, as far as the feeling the authenticity from the comic to the screen. It's unbelievable. It is stunning. And it's a beautiful show. And my wife, who does not give a flip about any of the stuff I like, she was riveted by Sandman. She's still talking about it. And we've been done for like a week. So I cannot recommend that highly enough. And if you've never read the comics, you know what? It's really good anyway. She's never read the comics and she enjoyed it, so it's worth watching.
Well, I gotta check that out for sure.
So did you have any more? You said you had five. So do you have more?
I was counting the original version of Flash of Two Worlds and the original Hal and Alan meeting and fighting Krona. So, you know, I had two for each of those.
Well, I'll cheat a little bit. Like, I had others in mind. I'm not going to actually rattle any off, but like, I like Jay, Garrick, and Wally, like, there were so many times they teamed up, which was great, or even with Bart, and I covered a lot of those in the Jay Garrick spotlight we did, or Rex Tyler and the Robotic Hour Man, and like, there's a moment for Al Pratt. Al Pratt and Ray Palmer have a great moment in JLA Incarnations number one, but we covered that back during JS April, and then it could have just gone on just about Ted Knight interacting with Jack Knight throughout the whole Starman series. That would have worked too. So so many great appearances. And folks, again, I want to hear in the comments your favorite moments where a JSA character gets to meet their legacy and they interact. I mean, it doesn't have to be their first meeting. It could be just any meeting between them, but they get to interact and hang out and do something together. So share your thoughts in the comments.
I didn't even think of Starman because it's so organic to the series that there's just a presence of the two of them together in a way.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and you could, I mean, really, there's six Starmen in that series. I mean, you could talk about Michael, you could talk about David, you could talk, you know, it goes on and on and on. So, and let's get into this. So we are going to talk about Justice Society of America number 9. If you want to see a few images from this issue, you can go out to our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. We will have a gallery post, but remember, you can get these comics in the floppies. You can read them online. If you're in England, you can buy that collection that's coming out of this series. So these things are available. So I'm only going to post a few pages out there. So it's published by DC Comics, cover dated April 1993, but it was on the shelves March 2nd, 1993. Cover price is $1.25, five shiny quarters. The cover is by Mike Paraback and Mike Macklin. You want to describe the cover for us?
In the sky above the Gotham Broadcasting Company, Green Lantern, Alan Scott, and XGL, Guy Gardner, trade blows. Their respective green and yellow power rings each casting a glow on each other. It's a battle of wills! !
All right. So yeah, it's a nice close-up of them. They've got to be probably 40 stories up, trading blows or trading ring slinging, whatever you want to say. You got the Justice Society logo is in white and yellow with a red border around it. You've got the corner box. The corner box. I love the corner box. You've got Al Pratt, little Al Pratt running through there, just ducking under the April 93 logo. Makes me so happy. And then the corner box, like the UPC code, has the JSA logo, which I absolutely love that. It's based on their font for their or their logo, whatever, and just get to see that JSA there as well. So what do you think of the cover, buddy?
Well, I ended up with the barcode version because I bought it off eBay. But as a side note, like, you need to do a podcast about corner boxes because I want to know, like, why they're there sometimes and why they're not. Like, you know, get someone, do an interview with Mike Carlin or whoever and just tell me, like, why.
Hey, Mike Carlin, could you tell me about the letter, the corner boxes? And by the way, why did you kill this series?
Yeah, I mean, you lead with the first question and then you sneak that one in.
Right. So,
yeah. So I think this cover is really cool and dynamic and they're obviously fighting. And so I was wondering if it needs a word balloon to, like, you know, somebody yelling something. I know you love the word balloons.
I do love a word balloon.
Yeah. Issue 7 had one, but there's no, like, explanation for why. So I think that's kind of a good thing because it's like, oh, I want to buy this and find out why they're fighting. I mean, they're fighting because Guy's a jerk, obviously, but, you know, the actual story points. one thing that I've noticed in reading this series is the way the JSA characters are drawn is kind of like unique to this series. It doesn't really carry forward, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't come from necessarily like something that's already established. So Alan has this receding hairline, which as far as I can tell, doesn't really show up again. I'm not sure if you know for sure.
Well, it goes all the way back to an Infinity Inc. story where he revealed that he was wearing a toupee.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I know. So they picked up on that either accidentally or on purpose. I don't know which, but they gave him the receding hairline here, which I love. I think it looks great. But yeah, sure, part of it is, a lot of artists draw him with a full head of hair. And then shortly after this, he actually gets regressed to a young age again. So he does have a full head of hair. So there isn't a ton of opportunities for him to have the receding hairline. But yeah, Parabak really leans into it with a very stylized, you know, Batman animated series kind of look before he was working on Batman animated series.
Right. And I do kind of resent that, because if you de-aged me, I still wouldn't have any hair, but whatever.
Right. You'd have to go back to about 12 for me before I'd have a
me
full
too.
Head.
So Guy's face is like, it's got a lot more detail. It's got a lot more like regular comic book drawing, and I'm not sure why.
Yeah, that is interesting. So, yeah, Parabek tries to make Guy Gardner's face less stylized. Like, I mentioned that, you know, we'll just call it the Bruce Timm style, even though, again, I want to remind everyone, Parabek was drawing this in this style before Bruce Timm was doing Batman, so this predates that. It's just a happy accident, you know, that they both came out with the same style. But either way, so Guy's face looks, again, like you said, much more traditional superhero, less stylized. And it's weird because inside, Guy is stylized in that style that Parabek does. So I have some speculation here. And that's all it is, speculation, is that sometimes the covers are done months in advance of the issue itself because they got to promote it. So maybe Parabek like changed his mind about how to draw Guy's face after doing the cover. I'm not really sure, because otherwise it is very strange that Guy, I mean, it literally looks like two different artists drew it.
Yeah, it's like he's the guest character, so it's just in his style, but that doesn't really, you know, make sense, I don't think, but
right?
I don't know. So the other thing about it is they're both punching, but it looks like they both missed. Like, am I right about that? Because these are two great poses, but they're passing each other. It's like, almost like you had a film of them and you picked a different frame for each of them and then you just photoshopped them together or something. It's like they couldn't both have missed.
It's like color forms. They just put them on top of each other. That's a great point. I hadn't thought about that. In my mind, they were ring slinging, but why would they be ring slinging like 3 inches from each other's faces? Yeah. Good point. Good point. Oh, wow. Okay.
And the other thing that's cool about it is like the glowing off each ring. It's kind of looks weird a little bit because, you know, the green ring is glowing onto the yellow logo on Guy's uniform there, and then the yellow is glowing onto the, you know, the green pants and stuff. So I'm wondering, is like, do you think this is like the early computer coloring kind of technique, or is it actually, I'm sure there's like a manual way to do that I'm just, you know, not aware of, but it feels almost like a not Photoshop obviously, but like a computer coloring sort of glowy thing.
Yeah, I know. I think you're absolutely right. I think it is some sort of radius, you know, airbrush tool or something like that, because like, I don't remember seeing this kind of effect done with Green Lantern rings and other comics like this. I don't want to say this is the only time it was ever done, but it's really unusual, because usually like the ring glows or something. But yeah, here there's a good radius that's like, I don't know, it 2-inch diameter, maybe it's more, maybe it's not quite that much, but it's huge. Look at the one around Alan Scott's ring. Okay, so it's a green circle around there, and there's that radius or diameter or whatever, and then there's purposeful coloring like on Guy's pants. He's obviously that's purposely been colored green, but the other one, I think you're right. I think that's kind of some sort of computer coloring. I think you're right. I think that's what they did.
And it doesn't really, I mean, it shows on the logo, but not on the black jacket. So, I mean, it's definitely a great effect. It's just, it's curious. I'm just wondering how they even created this at this point. And then the background also kind of has like a gradient going on, which I'm sure you could do, like, you know, with actual art tools, but you could also probably could have done it with a computer back in the early 90s as well.
A good point. Well, even the Justice Society logo goes from white to yellow. That's also got a gradient going so as well.
Maybe you should get Rob on here and ask him, like, how do you do this? Like, call him up or something. I don't know.
That guy. With that guy. One of the things I want to mention, since we're talking about coloring, is I love the cityscape, because it's, first of all, it's very detailed. Must have took them forever to draw all those straight lines with a ruler. Drove them mad. But I do, and you get to the GBC building, which is great. But I do love, it was very clever on the colors part, to make all the colors in the background very bland. They're all like taupe or like a lilac kind of thing. I mean, there's there's differences in the building colors, but they're all very beigey, if you will, in order to make the heroes pop more. more. So I think that was very clever on their part to make sure the heroes really pop, because it is, if the background was too colorful, it would be very distracting and hard to figure out what you look at, what to look at.
Did you say taupe?
I was trying to say taupe, but I may say
I have no idea what color that is, but I'll allow it.
It's a beigey kind of boring color. Because again, there's some lilacs, there's some taupes, there's a little bit of reddish, but again, they're all very dull on purpose.
And there's like a strange like detail and then not detail. It's like, it's really interesting. And there's a billboard that just says it's black. It doesn't have any like coloring on it or details or lines or anything like that. So it kind of looks like Alan dropped his iPad.
You know what? We're going to say that's what it was. He dropped Alan dropped his iPad that he brought back from the future. It's exactly what it was. All right, let's get into this. So inside, we've got writer Len Strazewski, penciler Mike Parabek, inkers Mike Macklin, letterer Robert M. Panaha, colorist Glenn Whitmore, and editor Brian Augustine. That crews together for, this isn't the last issue, but it is the second to the last issue. So the issue itself is called Hearts of Darkness, Eyes of Hate. You want to start us off?
All right, so we get the opening splash. Jay Garrick recoils. No, not that. On the next page, we see him dodging beloved gifts and trinkets thrown by his wife, Joan. Joan's mad about pretty much everything. Despite admitting that she doesn't know why, she kicks him out of the house. As he races off, confused, Joan thinks to herself, I hate you, Jay Garrick, but I don't know why. Meanwhile, in Gotham, Dr. Charles McNider is listening to a radio report about the death of an actor from AIDS-related complications. He remembers this actor, who isn't named, as a stage actor because he's never seen his later TV work, you know, being blind at all. But he says he doesn't think he's missed much because TV brings out the worst in people. There's a knock at the door from a biker who needs help, like he's injured. But as soon as he sees Doc McNider, he refuses to be treated by him, punches him, and passes out. This is kind of confusing to the good doctor and his assistant, Louise, but it makes it much easier to help him because he's unconscious now. We check in on Rex and Rick Tyler, still in Rick's hospital room from last issue. Rick is a few hours away from chemotherapy treatment, and Rex wants him to try to invoke the Hourman powers without Miraclo. He helps Rick try the same mantra that he worked on last issue, telling him to remember how the drug made him feel. Rick remembers. Cut to JSA headquarters as Al Pratt and Ted Grant are trying to change a fuse. The contractors abruptly quit after lunch that day, leaving the HQ renovation unfinished. As they get the lights on, Jay arrives and tells the guys he was kicked out by Joan. On a nearby rooftop, Johnny Thunder calls the Thunderbolt to keep him company and to complain about how the women in his life want nothing to do with him. Thunderbolt knows he's terrible with women, and he won't confirm or deny that Johnny has bad breath, but he can tell there's some weird magic going on. Johnny decides to tell everyone else tomorrow morning, but Thunderbolt is tired of listening to him, so he goes to investigate the familiar magic right now. Johnny tries to call him back a few minutes later, but he doesn't show up. Cut to this hit sensational news magazine, Current Affairs Spotlight, airing on GBC. They're running a hit piece on the JSA about the various times the team has disappeared and are reporting on their supposed real activities during those long absences, including spying for the government on the free speech movement in the 60s. And hey, they're just asking questions here. Possibly selling their services to the Soviet Union? Maybe hiding out in Red China? Sources say that's what happened. Suddenly, an angry green beam of anger smashes the TV and someone off-panel yells, "That's a lie!"
All right, I'll take it from here. So Alan Scott has lost his cool and smashed his television after he watched his own TV station spew anti-JSA rubbish. Alan suits up his Green Lantern and begins flying downtown to the TV station. But before he can get very far, pow! He's clocked by a giant yellow fist, courtesy of Guy Gardner, who's rocking a black leather jacket and a Sinestro-style power ring. Guy's been duped by propaganda and thinks Alan's gone full commie. This results in an epic green versus yellow ring-slinging throwdown over Gotham, complete with a jaw-dropping two-page spread. The rest of the JSA rush in to help, but Green Lantern's got it handled. Alan doesn't need assistance, outwitting Guy Gardner, and then drops Guy with one punch. But just as things begin to settle, an angry mob surrounds the team, hurling accusations like commies and fascists. Green Lantern throws up a protective bubble to separate the JSA from the mob for the protection of both groups. Johnny Thunder suspects something darker than bad public relations. He says it's sorcery. Just then, a wooden park bench flies through the Emerald Barrier, knocking Green Lantern out cold, and the protective bubble collapses. The JSA is forced to fight civilians. Just when things look bleak, Carter Hall Hawkman rolls up in a limo. What a coincidence! He whisks the team away, but Green Lantern wakes up and connects the dots. Kulak the Sorcerer is behind it all, and Carter's in on it. The final page features the JSA delivered straight to Kulak, who's got the Badnesian Thunderbolt impaled like a trophy. And standing beside him is a clearly possessed Hawkgirl. Dun-dun! To be continued. And then the next issue box on the letters page says, "The grand finale of the series is the JSA must go up against insurmountable odds. At the hands of Kulak, the JSA makes its last stand defending the world. What will happen to them after next issue? You'll just have to be there." All right. So lots to unpack here. Why don't you start us off, buddy? What'd you think?
I thought this was a lot of fun. I'm invested in the story. I think more so like these final three issues, what the plot that's going on right now than maybe the last couple. But I like seeing these characters. I like the places they're put in. And I think it's really handled with a lot of characterization and then also action, you know, which is always cool. I mean, when Guy Gardner shows up, of course, there's going to be like, you know, punches and stuff.
And I'm right there with you. It's a very character heavy piece. I really do get a chance to I really feel for Joan and Jay. Like, Joan looks so sad that she is mad at Jay and has no idea why. So they really get a chance to pack a lot of character moments in here. If you love the JSA, you're going to be satisfied with that piece of it. And Kulak is almost, like, his identity is almost surplus to needs. Like, none of us remember who this guy is. It doesn't really matter.
I had no idea.
Right, exactly. But what matters is the world is turned on the JSA, and that's hurtful, right? And that's hurtful for them. It's sad for us. It makes a really interesting story to watch these beloved characters be on the back foot and have to be like, what did we do wrong? We didn't do anything. So it was good stuff.
Yeah, that opening fight between the two of them, it sort of starts off as like the sitcom angry wife, you know, sort of cliche thing. But, you know, quickly, it's just about an emotional moment where these two people don't really know what's going on. And it's like, I won't say I've exactly been there, but it's like sometimes you're just fighting with your spouse and you're like, why are we fighting? I don't know what's happening here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's real life, man. It really is.
And you know, at one point, which was kind of interesting, she says, like, one of the things she throws at him is like, you're young, you're a monster, mm-hmm. you're a freak. And I'm not sure if that's talking about something that happened to them since they returned in Armageddon Inferno, or if like she's referencing the whole Ian Carcool thing that gets talked about at length.
So thankfully, the Ian Carcool thing has sort of been forgotten at this point. Okay. And now what they're saying is being in Ragnarok gave them a lot of stamina, and they're younger than they should be. So like this point, he's probably born in like 1920, let's say. Yeah. And this is 1993, so he should be 73 years old. But they're saying he appears to be like more like his early 60s or late 50s. So that's more like where his stamina is. So she's bothered because she's 73, right? And she was a hottie, by the way, back in the day. She was like the most gorgeous woman on campus, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so here she's having to face aging while her husband isn't. And so that's the crux of the argument.
Yeah, because I think in the previous continuity, it was like the spouses were somehow affected also. So they were also young. But okay, that makes sense. And that's definitely like a genuine fear that she might have, but probably would choose to, you know, deal with in a more constructive way than throwing stuff at him.
Well, and as we're going to find out, what's really going on, obviously, is the Kulak anger is affecting her. But on that page three, that last panel of her, Jay's left, and she's leaning against the window, looking out the window, and you read the quote, "I hate you, Jay Garrick, but I don't know why." Like, that panel looks like it's like right out of a romance comic, because Parabek's such a great cartoonist. The emotion is there, the tears. I just love that panel.
Yeah, it's perfect. All the emotions that she throws through the whole thing, it's just like, it hits every different kind of beat.
Yep.
Another thing that I'm curious about is one of the pictures on their mantle is him as the Flash. So do they just not care about secret identities at this point?
I think we established, or someone, maybe Martin Gray came up with it, whatever, when we did the Jay Garrick spotlight, I think we determined that his superhero identity is public now.
Okay, cool.
So in fact, they did a whole magazine shoot in a Flash comic where they were like posing for like a photo shoot as the Flash and his wife. Yeah.
Nice.
Okay. But that was like 1998. So I don't know. Somewhere in there, his identity goes public.
Yeah, makes sense. And it's fine if he's just too old to care. Like, we all get there eventually.
Right.
Okay, so moving on to the next scene with Dr. Midnight. He's listening to the radio, and it's about, you know, it feels organic that he's listening to this subject and he has some thoughts on it. Of course, you know, he's a doctor and everything. So they're talking about someone who died of AIDS. But the curious thing to me is they don't actually say who it is. They say he used to be a Shakespearean actor. And then you find out through conversation that, you know, he kind of ended up being like a TV star, and he was like the sidekick of a comic book hero. So I don't even know if they're talking about a real person or if it's supposed to like reference somebody. Like, I'm not sure where they're going with this. other than they're saying, you know, the conclusion is that, well, you know, TV's bad, but.
Right. Well, they're right about that. But yeah. I don't know either. I spent a little bit of time trying to research this. I can't figure out who you're talking about either. Folks, if you know, let us know. Everything that Devin just said about the character, like so someone who dies around 1993 of AIDS-related, they were an actor, Shakespearean actor originally, that ends up on TV playing a stuffy professor as a sidekick to a superhero character. I got no idea. And someone at home is going to say, and we're both going to slap our head and go, I should have had a V8 and go, oh, of course it's that person. But I did research and I couldn't figure it out either. The one thing I want to note about this is 9:48 at night and Louise or Louisa is saying goodnight at that point. And I'm like, man, they work long hours at that
job. Yeah. Well, he's Dr. Midnight. He's got a couple more hours, I guess.
He punches in for a second job.
Yeah. The other thing he says, I'm glad I don't watch TV because it seems to bring out the worst in people. And I'm like, dude, you're not ready for that free trial of AOL. Not one bit.
Well, you know, he's probably got a stack of the CDs on his desk because they mail them to you whether you want them or not.
Yeah, and he's smart not to, like, even go there yet.
Oh, my gosh. Well, there's a moment here that I found very powerful when he's just talking about how he's having a hard time dealing with the world the way it is and all the strife and drama and everything. And he's like, how do you deal with it all? And she has this line and she says, you know, we cope, Charles. We have no choice. And boy, that is a line that is true today as it was in 1993. We just cope. It's all we can do nowadays, it seems like.
Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, so much has changed since we were gone. And it's like, well, since 1986, I guess. There's a bunch of things have changed. But, you know, I'm looking back at this 32 years.
Yeah, right. Well, all right. So it's interesting. Later in the comic, just a bit of a call forward, they actually call it out. They specifically state that the JSA was in Ragnarok for 3 years.
Okay.
So they say that from Crisis to them returning was 3 years. So we know. So you're right. How much did the world really change in those 3 years? I don't really know.
I guess communism fell. So that's a big deal.
And yeah.
Cold War. All right. Yeah. I'll give it to him. It's fine.
Okay. Fair enough. It works. You know, prize it.
So then this dude knocks at the door. And, you know, here, as far as the art goes, I got a little confused over the sequence of panels. And maybe it's just me, but, you know, the biker guy, he bangs on the door with his elbow or something like that. And there's a sound effect. And then the panel right below it is actually Dr. Midnight getting punched, but it overlaps to the point where I thought, like, I'm seeing the bottom of the same action because they both have, like, these big sound effects and a yellow, like, sort of burst around them. So I read, you know, from the first panel down to the third panel, actually, and I skipped the second panel. I'm like, I'm really confused by this, but I don't know if that was just me or if you thought so, too.
No, it's not just you at all. No, this is one of the few times I'll call out a Parabek fail on page layout. Because, mm-hmm. Yeah, it absolutely looks like that first panel, he's knocking Dr. McKnight are out, and you got to read, like you said, but you got to get through all three panels to go, oh, I wasn't reading that right at all.
Yeah,
so yeah, okay. No, it's unfortunate. It's also the knock knock and the wham also share the same sort of yellow burst. Also the red blood on the guy's arm looks like something else as well, like another mm-hmm. explosion. So yeah, it's confusing. Now, one thing, you know, as we're talking about, I did not notice before that guy, he actually has the Kulak eye on his arm.
Right.
I didn't notice that before now.
Hmm.
So I got a question here. Why does he push McKnighter away? Why does he say, not him, not him, not him? Like, McKnighter's identity is not public as far as I know.
Yeah, it seems like almost like the sorcery or magic or whatever is like informing him that this is someone that he hates all of a sudden. And so he's not going to be treated by him, even though he came here specifically to get medical assistance.
Okay.
But it must be, you know, part of the whole mind control thing. But, you know, also maybe a failing of the script is it doesn't necessarily tell us exactly what we need to know to figure this out. You know, it is a mystery, so we do find out eventually. But it's an odd situation that isn't lingered on enough for me to kind of, like, you know, figure it out, I guess.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Oh, my gosh. Did I just put something together? So hold on here. Looking back, Louisa says that she is finishing the lab results. I'm turning in, right, is what she says. She doesn't say I'm going home. She says I'm turning in. And then when that guy comes barging in, she's holding her, like, looks like a bathrobe closed. So she lives above the clinic. And when you tell someone I'm turning in, like, are they a couple?
Interesting.
he might be robbing the cradle here pretty severely, actually.
Fascinating.
I never thought about it. I don't think it's ever explored. But if you look at the way she's clinging her shirt closed and her saying, I'm turning in. Yeah, I think she lives mm-hmm. at the clinic and he's there at 10 o'clock at night. So maybe they're shacking up, or maybe they just both live there. Or like you said, maybe he's getting ready to punch the clock at midnight and go to work there.
Yeah. And he's an old guy. So the loosened tie is pretty much like, you know, dead casual. Like, I'm relaxing now. Loosened my tie. I haven't put comfortable clothes on, but I'm still wearing my suit, but the tie is loosened. Yeah. Therefore, I'm ready to have a good time with you. Yeah, definitely.
Maybe there are a couple. Folks, let us know what you think at home on that one.
Okay, so then we move on to the page about Rex Tyler and Rick Tyler. And obviously, I think I know that he somehow gets better. But it's like, to see someone who's kind of discovered something a little bit like new agey and like, you know, kind of like, this worked awesome for me. And they tell you, I think it'll cure your cancer. Like, maybe that's like, it feels so desperate and uncomfortable in a way of him trying this. And, you know, it works, which is cool. I assume it works next issue or something along those lines. But, you know, it's like you guys talked about it last issue, but you really feel for him and his situation is, I'll try anything. And it's, you know, fortunate happenstance that they both kind of have this internal, like, powers, metagene, whatever it is, that they can actually call on. So it's just one page, and it doesn't really have anything to do with the rest of the story, but I'm glad it's there.
I think it's powerful in that, like you said, desperation is the word. I mean, like, as a parent myself, I know there's no line I wouldn't cross to help save my kid. So it is absolute desperation, absolutely forcing something on him a little bit because he thinks it's going to work. But at the same time, I also wonder if Len Straczynski realized, oh, crap, we're ending at issue 10. I got to wrap this up quicker. And mm-hmm. so maybe he had a longer tail on this story originally, and suddenly he's got to accelerate it all and fit certain, you know, subplots in.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, as a father of two boys, the father-son thing is just, it just kills me every time I read an old comic that I glossed over back in the day.
Yep.
I recently reread The Funeral for a Friend, The Death of Superman and everything in Pa Kent, and I can't take it. It's just so rough. I feel so bad for him when he's trying to save Clark's, you know, what he thinks may be his soul or whatever. Just the anguish and the emotions in that comic is just, it kills me in the way that it never did before.
I'm getting choked up right now.
Yeah.
There's a cover where, I'll get it out, where Jonathan is collapsed in the field mm-hmm. and Martha's going like, John, or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm going to stop talking about it right now. So moving on.
Let's just go to the fight pages or something.
Yep.
I don't know.
Yep. There we go.
Anyway, so then they go to, I think, is supposed to be JSA headquarters, or it's Ted Grant's gym. I'm not sure.
There it is. Yes, I got to correct you. It's not actually the JSA headquarters. It is supposed to be, because Ted and Al talked about buying a gym and opening it up. And if you look throughout all these scenes, they're surrounded by workout equipment. Okay. And I do remember them saying at some point that they were going to go work on the gym. Maybe it was last issue. I don't remember. But so, yeah, this is not supposed to be JSA headquarters. This is their gym. They're trying to get up and running.
Yeah, because, I mean, I thought it was kind of carrying forward the, like, let's get the team back together. But you're right. It makes a lot more sense because, like, I didn't really necessarily recognize that was Ted right away, because just last week I read those Wildcat comics that you covered. And, like, he looks totally different.
He does look very different.
I'm like, who is he? And there's a punching bag hanging next to him. Well, that must be Wildcat. It has to be. It didn't really connect to me that obviously he's been drawn this way the whole time, but he feels like, you know, a little bit more like fragile and old and stuff than I'm used to seeing him.
Yeah, no, you're right. After this series, they definitely toughen Ted back up. Yeah, Ted, mm-hmm. Ted becomes a tough, tough, tough guy again. So here they definitely softened him for a while. And really, he does look a little generic, but when you see Al, it's like, okay, they're always together. So it's got to be, you know, it's the Skipper and Gilligan. Got it. Mm-hmm. Understood.
Yeah. And the funny line here, Jay comes in and he says, Joan and I had a fight. She threw me out. And Al says, what? She hasn't done that in 20 years.
So obviously she's done it a few times.
Yeah. It must have been, you know, back in the 70s, I guess. It was just a regular thing.
I'm glad to say, knock on wood, I've never had to show up at a buddy's house and say, hey, you know, my wife threw me out. Can I crash here tonight? I hope I never have to say that.
That would be a problem.
Yeah. So is the bag full of clothes, or is that full of stuff he didn't want her to break?
Probably a mix. He might have made like three or four trips in the time they're having this conversation, actually.
That's right. Jay just kept taking more things away from Joan so she wouldn't break them.
Yeah. He says, oh, did you forget her birthday again? It's like, you know, it feels like just a random like sitcom spouse fight, but obviously we know there's much more going on.
Right. And at this point, though, I mean, there's nothing in Jay's situation that would make him wonder. I mean, it's certainly weird, right? Like, I don't understand why Joan threw me out, but there's nothing mm-hmm. inherently in that situation that's going to make him go, aha, it's, you know, a supervillain sorcery that's made my wife hate me. Yeah.
It's just that it happened, like, when he was in the bathroom brushing his teeth or something like that. Like, mm-hmm. that's what seems weird to him, and, you know, rightly so. But, yeah, there's no necessarily any, they're not on to anything at this point.
Yep.
Which is like, I like the slow burn of the sort of mystery.
Agreed.
So, next couple pages is Johnny Thunder and the Thunderbolt. And through the course of all of your podcasts, I've heard many people say how annoying Johnny Thunder is. And, like, I never really got it. I didn't know a ton about him. But after reading these pages, okay, I get it now.
Really? Like, I don't find him annoying at all here. So, you got to explain it to me. Tell me.
Okay, well, he's just sort of to the point where he's a little bit clueless. He says Pichu Pet and Kiku won't talk to him. And he doesn't know why. And Thunderbolt's kind of like, well, you know, I guess I was sleeping, but you called me anyway and stuff like that. And he's, you know, it's good to see you because no one wants to talk to me. And Thunderbolt's kind of like, yeah, I know. Not just you, the rest of the gang too. And it's just getting started or something like that.
Well, yeah, he mentions you're not always sensitive to the needs of the opposite sex.
There it is.
I like that he says that to him.
Exactly.
Because Johnny Thunder has been portrayed as a bit of a dick in the past. So here I think we've been given a softer version of Johnny, who I actually like. And the Thunderbolt is still saying, you know, hey, you're still a bit of an idiot, but, you know, it's something worth mentioning at least.
He's like, oh, okay, well, that's interesting that there's sorcery involved. I guess we'll just deal with it in the morning. And Thunderbolt's like, yeah, I got to find out some more about this. And he just takes off.
I would agree. Saying we'll deal with it in the morning is very irresponsible on his part.
Yeah, that's not what you want in your superhero.
Right.
Well, I'll just call them in the morning. I don't want to disturb anyone or whatever. And then in general, I was wondering, like, why they kind of draw him relatively young here. And I think you maybe answered this before, but it feels like he's 35 or something like that at the most.
He does look younger. I think he's still supposed to be in the 50s, probably. So it's probably just a failure on the arts part to achieve that. He is definitely one of the youngest members of the JSA. Mm-hmm. But it's only fractionally at that point. Once you get to be in your 50s, 60s, 70s, what's young at that point, right? So, mm-hmm. yeah, I don't think he's supposed to be in his 30s. I think he's supposed to be in his 50s. But, yeah, you're right. The art does portray him looking a lot like younger than that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's and I didn't look back to see if it's been consistent throughout, but I'm sure it has. So then we get Current Affairs Spotlight, which is to the T, a spot on accurate depiction of this type of TV, which I kind of forgot about because these are like the syndicated half hour tabloids that were quote unquote news. And mm-hmm. they were sort of like the prototype of like the 24-hour sensationalist news garbage channels that we have now. But this was what came first, and it was trying to appeal to the same mentality in a way. It was like, what are all these things you should be scared of and that are horrible? And we have all this investigative journalism, which is, you know, mostly probably made up and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it took me back to like, oh yeah, these were totally a thing. And this is absolutely what they were like.
Oh, you're dead on. Absolutely. Like, I can't remember the names of any of them, but yeah, you're right. They'd have those syndicated little 30-minute shows and very sensationalist. And it absolutely is the forerunner of 24-hour news. And one of the things I love that they do here, you called it out in your comments there, is everything they say is purely speculative. They, like, they're mm-hmm. dancing around being sued by saying, you know, what if they went to China? What if they went to... So they don't necessarily say that. I mean, eventually they say one of our sources, but it's that careful, litigious way of throwing shade and trying to dodge being sued. And it is gross and it's disgusting, but it's real. And I'm glad they portrayed it here.
Yeah, it's like, it's so accurate. It's hard to remember that they're under a spell, like they're being mind controlled.
Right.
You know, TV was really like this. And I think it was one of them was called A Current Affair. I don't remember what the other ones were, but that was the one that had like the dong sound effect.
Yeah. Well, a couple different things is going on here, which I think is fun. First of all, not fun, but interesting. So, again, they accuse the JSA of working for Russia and China. And this is all obviously the propaganda being fueled by the sorcery to make people hate the JSA. So one of the things that Parabek's done very cleverly is there are two facing pages. So on the left's page 10, on the right's page 11. And what you're getting is like similar TVs, little TVs with shots all over. But on the left-hand side, you see the Current Affairs logo. And then on the right-hand side, you see the Current Affairs logo again. But on the right-hand side, the logo has been changed slightly, and they've added the Eye of Kulak above the logo. and unless you're really looking for it, you won't catch it. And I thought that was a really clever artistic touch.
And I would recognize it if I knew who Kulak was.
Well, I only know it because we've been seeing for the last two issues this reoccurring eye motif. That's the only reason I know it.
Definitely. So at the bottom of the page, Alan smashes it with a power ring beam. Mm-hmm. And he goes, "That's a lie." Now, I'm wondering, like, is this to you in character with him of being sort of so angry he smashes his TV and he's outraged and he's ready to take action? Like, to me, he's the elder statesman, the sort of like reasonable person because he's seen everything and he's not going to like fly off the handle. So is he being affected by the anger spell as well? Or do you think this is like totally in character for him?
That's a good question. I haven't seen him fly off the handle with anger before. But then again, the circumstances are pretty rough. I mean, he's literally being called a communist and a fascist on his own TV network. So I could see anyone losing their temper in that situation. It is unusual for him, but at the same time, I think this would be just about as mad as you're ever going to see him unless there's some danger directly to Molly. I think this is about as close as you're going to get to him being furious.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, he takes a fist from Guy Gardner as soon as he flies outside, which is awesome.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, let's talk about Guy. So just for a second here, folks, if you're not terribly familiar with Guy Gardner as far as this specific version of him. So Guy Gardner loses the Green Lantern ring and eventually ends up getting himself Sinestro's yellow power ring in July 1992. And then he's lost that ring by early 1994. So for that like 18-month period, he's running around in a black leather jacket with a big yellow G on it, and he's got like jeans and cowboy boots and slinging a yellow ring. To me, it's weird. Like, I felt like this period was much longer than 18 months. I'm shocked, actually, to find out it was only 18 months doing the research. But so this story falls right in that middle of that yellow ring era for Guy. So that's why he's slinging the yellow ring, if you're not familiar with that. But I do like the way they handle Guy here. I feel like his attitude and his, quite frankly, ignorance is pretty faithful to his JLI appearances, actually.
Absolutely. Of course, you know, that's his favorite show that he was just watching. Like, he's absolutely the target audience. They've nailed it. They've convinced him, and he's not going to hear it from anyone else because he saw it on Current Affairs Spotlight, which is, I'm sure he's gone off the handle. This might be a regular thing for him, even when the Kulak's not involved at all. Whatever he sees on that show, he's going to fly off and start cracking heads and stuff. Because I think around the same time, he goes after one of the fake Supermen, and, you know, they start, you know, have a fight. And it's the same kind of thing where he heard something, so he's, well, I'm outraged. I'm going to fly off to another city. So it's perfect. And the yellow ring guy was like kind of where I left him when I was last reading comics in the 90s, and then eventually came back to like Green Lantern Corps Recharge and all that stuff where he gets his green ring again. But to me, even though I was fully aware of that whole alien DNA thing for a long time, but mm-hmm. this is the Guy Gardner I think of when I'm thinking of, like, you know, latter day, you know, yellow ring, going around like a crazy person, and but also, you know, occasionally heroic.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I mean, he thinks he's being heroic here.
Yeah.
He thinks he's confronting, you know, someone who's a traitor to our country. So that's fair. And honestly, yeah, I at no point in this comic did I think he's affected by Kulak. I think Guy Gardner's just being a dick.
Yeah, it's just how he is.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think he's affected by Kulak at all. It reminds me a lot of like the early JLI issues when they're in like in the Soviet Union, and he's just like, yeehaw, let's go fight. And he just wants to go punch a Russian. So yeah, that's who this Guy Gardner feels like, and it works.
Yeah, so I wanted to figure out if Guy and Alan had ever met, because, you know, in Crisis the Green Lanterns were off doing something else, so they didn't overlap there. And then Last Days of the JSA, and they're out of there. So the only time I can find that they met were in Green Lantern 18. Guy and the other Green Lanterns talked to Alan's power battery for some reason. It manifested as a ghost of him or something. So that doesn't count. But then in the end of Armageddon Inferno number 4, there's like a big panel of all the heroes talking to each other, and you don't hear what they say, but they're facing each other and having some sort of conversation. So that might be the only other time that they've interacted.
Interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Now, I think that Alan's appearing in Green Lantern Quarterly by this point. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there was an issue where they interacted with Alan. Well, either way, Alan clearly knows who Guy is.
Yeah.
And it's not like, this doesn't feel like their first meeting. It feels like he knows who he is. And he's like, I don't have time for fake Green Lanterns right now. So mm-hmm. it feels like he knows who he is. So I'm going to assume they've met before here, and we're just forgetting an appearance. In fact, you know, folks at home, chime in. If you can remember them interacting and maybe some of those early Green Lantern issues before Hal went crazy, I don't know. Somewhere mm-hmm. there, it must have been.
Yeah. It's very on brand for him to think that his yellow ring is going to work perfectly and take a swing. Mm-hmm. And nothing happens.
That two-page spread, man, is freaking gorgeous. So pages 14 and 15, again, it's similar to the cover. They're flying up in the air. Alan's very close to the camera, and he's got like a shield he's made. Paravac did a great job drawing him. It's a great shot of Guy smashing a big yellow mallet against the green. I mean, I love this two-page spread.
When I was writing my notes, I was searching for the word. It's Green Lantern Constructs is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And Yellow Lantern, obviously, too. They're perfect for this art style because they can be, you know, comic book like or animation like or whatever, and they can be anything. And so it's awesome to see them trying all the different things against each other, and particularly the mallet against the shield. And he says, I was ringing up giant mallets when you were in diapers.
And then typically Guy, he says, yeah, which side were you on back then, Hitler or Stalin? Yeah. Gah. Oh, yeah. I love to hate Guy. I love to hate Guy.
So, you know, eventually, like, Alan does, like, they both do some pretty cool moves, like I was saying. And I think on page 16, panel 3, like, to me, this is the frame that they showed to Nathan Fillion and said, okay, this is how you're supposed to look. Just make this expression the entire movie, okay?
That's fair. That's fair.
Like he's annoyed and confused at the same time. And, you know, maybe he smells a fart and he's trying to figure out if it's his. I don't know.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, you did describe it perfectly. I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you.
Because, like, when they cast him, I was like, well, he doesn't look like him at all. But in the movie, he looks exactly like him. Like,
yes.
It's just the expression. I was like, is that a prosthetic? Obviously, the haircut. But, like, this on this page is how he looks. It's amazing.
They really did an astonishing job with the film. Unbelievably. Yeah.
So, next page, page 17, Alan gets the upper hand because, you know, he's more creative and he's not a complete idiot and he's just more experienced. And so he does something I never thought of. He just puts a big weight around Guy's feet and he falls into the pavement.
Right. And I love that actually says 500 pounds right on it.
Yeah. He says, well, now I'm really mad.
I love the JSA is there to support him, but he doesn't need their help, does he?
Yeah, of course. And then I'm pretty sure you can't do this to a Green Lantern. You can't just pull the ring off his hand. But with a Yellow Lantern, like, why not? Like, they're technically not Yellow Lanterns at this point, but same idea. So he gets it off the hand and then hits him with one punch.
Thank you for that. Now I have to put the sound effect in.
Well, what sound effect is that? Is that the one that you play every time someone says one punch?
You do it again, you're kicked off the show.
I'm paying to be here. Come on. I do what I want.
Do you know how much it costs to insert that sound effect? It's like a V. It would cost them like $1,000 for every laser blast they had to put into the show. So come on, man. You're bankrupting the network here.
Those are the costs you've been talking about at length for, you know, a couple of years now. It's like, yes. It costs a lot to make this show. Yeah. I'm editing sound effects and I guess I pay royalties or something, whatever it is. Yeah.
Yep. That's exactly deal right. With
it. Yeah. People are going to come on your show and say that because that's your thing.
Just move on.
Okay. So the line I like a lot on page 19 is, how can we be communists and fascists at the same time? And then Wildcat says, maybe they think we're running for office.
It's astonishing. Here we sit, 30 years later, and certain things are still true, man.
It just hits you in that way. So many years.
So there are a couple things on page 19 I want to talk about. One is, you know, Alan gets hit by a wooden park bench, which I thought was really clever. Because first of all, if you look in the panel before, you actually see the guys in the background picking up the park bench. And they're like carrying it over. And then they chuck it through and it goes right through the barrier because it's wood, which is very clever.
Yep.
Not that they knew that, I don't think. But anyway, they throw it and they knock out Alan, which is great. And here on page 19 is where, like, at first I read this and I'm like, wait a minute, what's going on? Because Johnny Thunder reveals that sorcery is behind the problem at this point. However, that's the same moment Alan Scott's knocked out. So it's not until Alan wakes up that he realizes that Kulak's using sorcery. And that's what's causing all the problems with the JSA. Because one could argue, though, shouldn't have Alan ever realized it earlier? Because he saw Kulak on TV at the end of last issue. However, I would respond to that argument by saying, like, Alan, all he's really seen is media propaganda against his friends and like regular people acting like an angry mob. So really, if those are all the requirements that are necessary for sorcery, which is, again, propaganda and people acting like a crazy people and angry, then the real world we're facing must be up against sorcery every single second in our country right now. So there you have it. There you go.
You figured it out. Yeah.
Yep.
It's Kulak. He's after us all right now.
Kulak is responsible for the attitude in this country for the last, like, you know, 10 years. That's it. There it is.
If only it were that easy.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I do kind of have an issue with the storytelling of this page. Like, what you're saying is, like, yes, he saw Kulak last issue, and if I was paying attention and listening to a podcast, I would certainly know that. If I was picking it up off the newsstand and it was been a month since I read that issue, like there's nothing in here to remind me of that, that there's kind of this lingering thing. So it kind of, I don't know if it's intentional because it makes more of a mystery or if, but I think it would improve the tension if we somehow had called back to what he had seen. I don't know, one way or the other. I don't know how you feel about that though.
No, you're right. I mean, they've dropped a couple hints with the eyeballs, but that's really it. And that's pretty vague. Yeah, it probably could have used a little bit more of not hanging a lantern on it, no pun intended, specifically, but some sort of reminder
intended. That was definitely intended. Come on.
Shut up, you. Anyway, that Kulak is still hovering in the background would have been a good idea. Like, even if it was just Alan going, what's Kulak doing hanging out with Carter? You know, even if it was something as simple as that, yeah, to remind us that Kulak's out there, because you're right. There's been no mention of it, and we've seen Alan already here.
Even a thought balloon was like, you know, this is the second craziest thing that's happened to me today or whatever, you know, somehow some reference to like, you know, it obviously it's exposition, which always comes sometimes seems a little sloppy, but it just remind me to keep the tension up, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree.
But the next page, page 20, is a pretty cool, you know, non-fight because they're trying to not beat the crap out of these regular people. But I like the, you know, the composition and the different sort of tricks that they do.
I always think that's a great storytelling technique. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you handicap superheroes, put them up against regular people? Because they, you know, they can put their fist through their head and they don't want to do that. So how do we prevent doing that? So I always think that's a great trick. And I've used that in role-playing games myself. Like, how do you stop people? Well, you put them against regular people because they don't want to kill them.
Yeah. And then on page 21, when Carter Hall shows up, obviously it says it, but it just didn't really click to me that, oh, that's Carter Hall. And we've seen him previously and we kind of know what's up with him. But it's not emphasized enough. He's too far away in the panel. There's no kind of close up of him. And so it's a little confusing as to like what the fear would be that you have. If you remember all that, then you're like, oh, this is bad news. And you find out obviously by the bottom of the page that it's bad news, but it's, I don't know. Maybe it's intended to feel like, you know, a real genuine rescue and everyone's happy. So maybe there's that, but there's something else about it. Like when Alan breaks through the roof, I want to see Carter Hall's reaction to that, like, oh, this isn't going to work after all, or whatever he's feeling. But we get nothing. Like, there's no kind of like there's no shot of him. He has no like presence in the story other than like, oh, we know that he's here and we know that he's bad. So it's kind of a bad thing. But maybe like they're on page 21. They're like, we got to wrap this up because we have a really cool splash page on 22. So they just left all that out. That's what I'm guessing. But, you know, something about, I don't know if it's like inexperience because I think these guys are relatively new or something, but it just doesn't quite add up.
Well, you're right. I completely forgot that Carter had turned evil. So when he shows up, I'm like, oh, cool. Carter's there to save the day. That's awful big coincidence. And then, yeah, like at the moment Alan goes, wait, no. I'm like, oh, that's right. Now, they do show, and it's not obvious at all. They do show right before Alan bursts through the roof, they do pull up to the Keys of Power mansion, which is where Kulak's operating out of. So, again, I can only tell you that because I do a podcast on this and I analyze it panel by panel. Exactly. I would have totally never picked up on that. So yeah, from a storytelling perspective, it's a tough thing for the reader to get there. But I think at this point, it's like, I'm just going along with the roller coaster ride and I'm just getting to that last page and I'm going, holy crap, how are they going to get out of this? I think is where you're going to end up doing.
And it does make the last page more of a surprise if you kind of forgot all that stuff. So that I'll say that could be totally intentional because, again, I don't know who Kulak is, but I do kind of remember him from the previous issue. So I'm like, oh, okay, this is bad for them. But again, like the whole roof of the car is ripped off and you could have drawn Carter Hall in there looking evil or something like that. But otherwise, and that last page is fantastic.
Oh, it's great. And then I love the Benesian Thunderbolt is literally impaled on a pike. It's just, it's awful looking, which explains why he didn't come back earlier. Mm-hmm. And then Shiera Hall, I'm sorry, quite frankly, this is not me being like interested in grannies or something, but like Parabek draws a really hot Hawk Woman, and even though she's in her 70s, she looks great.
Well, she's immortal or something, or I don't know, one of those things. At some point, they established all those things. So yeah, she looks good.
They're drawing her very sexy and she's holding a whip. I mean, it's like totally like, you know, supposed to a tease sort of thing anyway. And then Kulak looks great. He's huge. He's like the size of like three dudes. He's massive.
Yeah, because he's got his arm around her wings and then also holding up the pike with a thunderbolt on it. And we know he's still alive because he's going, oh.
Right. Oh, good point. Good point. Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm looking forward to them wrapping up issue 10. I haven't read ahead or anything like that, but they've got a lot packed in there. And, like, you know, they need to address, you know, what happens with Rick and some other stuff like that. So, like, I'm looking forward. I think it's going to be a good issue.
Yeah, and I think overall, we found a few storytelling things that could have been improved. I think we found a few page layout things that weren't as ideal as they could be. But overall, I think it was an enjoyable issue. I really enjoyed this one quite a bit. There weren't glaring flaws that jumped out at me or anything. I thought the storytelling was good. I love the character moments. The raised tension at the end, regardless of whether it could have delivered a little better, is great because you're like, oh no! And I'm sad that it's going to end next issue. I don't remember if it wraps it up in a satisfying way or not, but I'm looking forward to finding out.
Yeah. And the one thing I was hoping they will follow up or could have in this issue is, like, what happened to those white supremacist guys? Like, they kind of, like, they're not involved anymore, I guess. I mean, it feels like they kind of got off light. They maybe could have circled back to them and somehow addressed, like, you know, what those guys, what their deal is, I guess.
Well, I'm hoping next issue they'll explain that they were powered by Kulak. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they all got defeated and arrested, I think. So I think their story was done, but it would be good next issue to for them to say, yes, Kulak's been affecting all town, you know, for a couple of weeks or something like that.
Yeah, because, like, was he trying to control those guys just to be, like, an annoying racist, or because he knew that the JSA was in that hospital? Like, I guess they'll explain it, I assume, but that's kind of what I was looking for here.
That's a good point, because, like, the previous issue was just all about everybody in town was angry, right? You know, now it's specific to the JSA. So I think, yeah, it's I feel like last issue they did a better job of conveying where it was all coming from, because we saw Kulak last issue. We saw Kulak with his special weird eye symbol last issue. We saw that same eye symbol on the white supremacist. So I feel like they actually conveyed it pretty well last time that it was coming from Kulak, better than they did this time.
I mean, it does all add up if you're paying attention. So I got to give them that. Like, I can't really complain.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, it's a monthly thing. So some people probably weren't. Some people were probably confused, but
yeah. Well, you got to work for it a little bit, I guess, is what they're thinking. Mm-hmm. So, a couple observations. There's no Jesse Quick or Kiku in this issue. They've been pretty much regulars for a while now, so no appearance of them. And then on the letters page, actually mentions that they're developing a Dr. Midnight miniseries by Matt Wagner, which did eventually come out, which we all love. And if you don't, you're just wrong. And then there's in the letters page, they also suggest an Hourman miniseries was being considered, which did not happen. Now, from the wording, I'm not entirely sure if they're saying that Hourman miniseries was also going to be by Matt Wagner or not. That the wording is a little hard to interpret. I suppose if it was a Matt Wagner's thing, he may have just ended up folding that into Sandman Mystery Theater, because I know Hourman appeared in there as well. So that could have been the case. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I checked out the letters page, too. And there was, like, two of the different letters mentioned that there were flip word balloons in issue 5, which I don't remember if you covered that specific problem or not. But they don't really respond to those points in the letters. And I guess printing them is their way of saying, oh, sorry.
I guess so. I mean, I think they're winding down. They know the sales are low. They know that this book's closing up shop next month. So I think that's some of what's going on, probably.
And I think the most surprising thing of maybe the entire issue was, check out Dark Stars number 6 and 7 for the Golden Age Hawks. What?
Yeah.
Why would they be in that?
The Golden Age, right. The Silver Age Hawks in space would make sense. The Golden Age? Really?
Well, yeah, why? I mean, I was curious enough that I looked, and there's actually someone who's, like, saying, well, you're a Thanagarian, so is he? He's like, I'm not a Thanagarian. Like,
oh, wow. I'm a human.
So it's purely intentional, but it's a very confusing story just from scanning it and taking a look. It's like, he just shows up, and they do some stuff, and then they leave. It's odd.
I knew they had the appearance. I hadn't gone back and checked, reread them. I mean, I would have read it when they came out, but I have no recollection whatsoever. Dark Stars is I know I read the book, but man, I don't remember it at all. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, but I always enjoyed the early issues of Green Lantern Corps Quarterly. So I'm glad that Alan's going to end up there, according to the letters page here.
Yeah, yeah, and we are going to talk about those when we do our Alan Scott Spotlight episode. So looking forward to it.
Cool.
All right, Devin. Well, this is the part of the show where we are going to nominate the All-Star Award. This is where we nominate our favorite moments from the issues, whether it's a story beat, something in the art, something that made us laugh, whatever. Both myself and Devin will pick one moment each to spotlight, and both of those moments will earn an All-Star Award. However, I will say, unless Devin is crazy pants, we should have both picked the same moment. But let's see what Devin picked.
You told me I'm not allowed to say it because you have to put in a sound effect.
Fine.
My favorite is definitely Alan Scott's One Punch.
Okay, that's a good one. That is not what I picked, shockingly. Okay. So that is a good moment. It is absolutely a great moment. It is very sad. It's very cathartic watching Alan knock out Guy Gardner. Watching anyone knock out Guy Gardner really is cathartic. But seeing Alan specifically knock him out is really, really quite pleasing. But I picked what the moment you should have picked as well, which is that amazing two-page spread on page 14 and 15 where Alan and Guy are floating above the city of Gotham and they're just doing giant constructs to each other. It's just such a gorgeous, gorgeous paperback page that I had to give that the All-Star Award for my sake.
It is awesome, but you hate editing sound effects so much that I thought I'd just throw another one in there.
Really appreciate that. You're really looking good to come back on my next show. Well, congratulations to Alan Scott and the One Punch. And the I hate you so much. And the and folks, do not think I'm going to do this on later episodes. If you come on the show and think you're going to be smart because Devin was, no, one-time thing. Anyway, and also congratulations to the Battle Above the Sky, the two-page spread. So both of those will be out in our gallery. So if you want to check those out, be sure to go out to our website. So Devin, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here for a few minutes and keep an eye on the unconscious Guy Gardner? I know you're a fan of the JLI book, so maybe if he wakes up, you can distract him with questions. I don't know, about General Glory or something.
Yeah, that's no problem. When Guy wakes up from those things that happen to him with a sound effect, he's always a lot nicer. We can sit around and talk about our feelings, or if that doesn't work, we can stream the new Superman movie, and he'll be happy about that, too.
That is absolutely perfect. I love it. Now, don't worry, Devin. We will bring you back at the end of the show, but after this podcast promo break, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called The Society Pages.
"2 months only, Halloween hoedown at the House of Frankenstein.
Your favorite Halloween party returns with 4 brand new episodes featuring cinematic horror classics and horror-filled superhero tales starring Superman, Batman, and Spider-Man.
Pin the bandage on Boris Karloff as the Mummy.
You will not remember what I show you now, and yet I shall awaken memories of love and crime and death.
Do the locomotion with Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing on the Horror Express.
Are you telling me that an ape that lived 2 million years ago got up to that crate, killed the baggage man, and put him in there?
Yes, I am. It's alive. It must be.
Bob for Apples with Hammer's The Reptile.
Get away from there! Get away!
Jam to the blues at this juke joint full of sinners.
We're gonna kill every last one of you.
This September and October, join the Supermates at FireAndWaterPodcast.com for the most happening haunt this side of the mausoleum, the House of Frankenstein. Halloween Hoedown!
The most irregular Batman podcast returns. Bailey's Batman Podcast is back with a new mandate and an actual honest-to-God release schedule. New episodes will drop the first Monday of every month with the host, Michael Bailey, that's me, that's the Bailey of Bailey's Batman Podcast, going through the Batman media that I've consumed in the previous month. Comics, movies, novels, audio dramas, music, everything Batman related is on the table. It's one part commentary show, one part reading journal, and 3 parts personal journey of both discovery and rediscovery as I head back to Gotham City to get reacquainted with a character that was my absolute favorite until a certain Man of Steel took over that spot. Bailey's Batman Podcast. It's back. For reals. I'm not just doing this to mess with Professor Alan Middleton. Promise.
The Society Pages. The The Society Pages is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episode. Now, just a little bit of news. DC Comics has announced a new holiday special coming in November called, I'm not making this up, it's called DC's I Saw Ma Hunkle Kissing Santa Claus. Oh my gosh. So it's got a variety of creators and it looks like a sort of an anthology of a bunch of stories. I'm assuming there's a Ma Hunkle story in there. So definitely check that out coming in November. Definitely going to be worth your time. Now, I have a question for you listeners. Is anyone listening going to be going to the Baltimore Comic Con October 17th through 19th? I'm curious. If so, let me know. I'll be there, as well as several other Fire & Water Podcast Network hosts and a whole bunch of other podcast friends. So it's always great to meet fellow JSA fans. All right, just as a reminder, get out on the social media. You can find us as JSA Presents on most of the socials. And as I always say, it's about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. Now, I do have a quick request. If you haven't left us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please consider doing that. It does really help raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. You can look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts for Justice Society Presents. And as a thank you, I will read your entire iTunes Apple Podcast review on the air. All right, now getting into your feedback from last episode, I've collected all those comments I could find on the social medias. I pulled emails, stuff on our website. That's where most of the comments come from, is our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. Anyway, put all that in a Google Doc, and I've got a lot of stuff to get through here, so we're going to get moving pretty quickly, but just know that I can't possibly read every word, so I'm just going to be making sure I recognize everyone, but just reading bits and pieces of your comments. And this is specifically covering the previous episode that was a spotlight on Ted Grant Wildcat with my guest, Stella. All right, first up is Brian Schufo. Says, excellent observation on the difference between young and old Wildcat. Following Wildcat's earlier stories on the Earth 2 podcast compared to the Wildcat in the 1990s, and from what I remember about JSA series in the 2000s, I enjoy old Wildcat as a mentor to younger heroes. He's been written as a teacher and a trainer, and is there any hero he didn't teach how to throw a punch? And it's more fun watching him with those young whippersnappers than with his peers. Well, thank you, Brian. And actually, a fellow commenter does answer that question. Is there anyone else who teaches superheroes? So let's get to that in a bit. Next up is Rob McCarthy, author of the book The Star and the Space Princesses and Other Stories. Rob says, Wildcat needs to be old because he comes from a time when people cared about boxing. Well, Rob, I will challenge you a bit because certainly, the 1940s was a big time, but also boxing had a huge presence in the 70s and the 80s. I don't know if it's been as big in the last, say, 40 years, but definitely through the 70s and 80s, it was still big. But then you could argue even then he'd have to be at least 50 or 60 years old. So he still would be an old guy, I guess. Then Rob also says, a Wildcat and Catwoman having a backstory and it never came up? He says, no, that never happened. Why would Ted Grant train a thief? When did Catwoman have time? I don't like it. But you can say, who else trained her that well? Maybe Richard Dragon? Well, Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for Girl blog chimes in on that very question and says, I'm not convinced Selena should have any special fighting training. She is one of the greatest thieves in the world and shouldn't be getting into situations where she has to tussle with the big boys. She should be all about agility and evasion, and that whip. Being trained by Wildcat has become such a cliche. Then Martin goes on to say, I like Wildcat in a team setting, but when I was a kid, he would mainly show up in what I felt like every sixth issue of Brave and the Bold, a non-superpowered person teaming up with the Batman in very similar colors, lacking only the cape. Writer Bob Haney seemed to prefer putting in non- or low-powered characters so you didn't have to go above the usual Batman-level threats. I was never pleased to see him. Then he says, his role as a trainer of every DC hero this side of Amazing Man has become a bit of a joke, and I do not need to think about him talking dirty to Selena in the bath. Mind, he does look amazing in JSA 9 and 10, fighting crime in a towel as drawn by the very daddy gay artist Steven Sadowski. Oh, that's great, Martin. And by the way, folks, that is going to be just the first mention of JSA number 10. That's going to come up a lot in these comments. A lot of people. That issue made a big impression on folks. Then we're here from Super Captain, who says, great show and one of my favorite JSA members. More blue collar than Batman and with the best right cross in the business. No one exemplifies being a mentor in the superhero community more than Ted Grant. I think the only other stories I've read out of the ones you guys mentioned was the Robin issue and the Zero Hour appearances. I got back into DC Comics through the Dixonverse, which is Nightwing, Robin, and Birds of Prey, in the late 90s, and didn't even know that the Batman Wildcat and Catwoman Wildcat miniseries exist. I'll definitely pick up the former soon. Well, that's great, Super Captain. And by the way, dude, the Dixonverse of Nightwing, Robin, and Birds of Prey, I love those books so much. They were fantastic. I bought every single one of those every month and was thrilled with what Chuck Dixon was putting out. I even got to tell him that once at a convention. It was really cool. Anyway, Super Captain says, and we get tips on some new slang in this episode as well. Thanks for helping me keep up with my millennial Gen Z kids, Stella. Well, yeah, she certainly delivered on the lingo, didn't she, Super Captain? Then we heard from movie Matt Sorois from the TV Movie Rewind podcast. Matt says, wow, great TED Talk. Ted Grant is in my top three JSAers, along with Jay Garrick and Alan Scott. I can tell you that I brought the Batman Wildcat miniseries and loved it. I picked up the first issue of the Catwoman Wildcat and decided not to buy the rest. Clearly, I didn't enjoy it, but honestly, I don't remember exactly why. Well, I think, Matt, we kind of covered some of those topics and maybe brought back some memories. I'm not sure. And then Matt says, as far as Wildcat's nine lives, they were all used up in JSA number 53. Wildcat was repeatedly killed by the Crimson Avenger, Jill Carlisle, due to her believing that Ted had committed murder. His nine lives are gone. I believe Ted now enjoys Meow Mix. Oh, wow. That took me a minute to catch the joke. Nine lives and Meow Mix. Very clever, Matt. Thank you. They heard from Tim Price from the Outcasters Batman and the Outsiders podcast and the Batgirl Huntress podcast. He says, I also think in JSA classified number 9 that Wildcat and Flash were in a tough spot. And Ted's big idea was, quote, I can intentionally let myself get killed to get us out of this. I think I have one life left. And Jay was like, you think? But then he got killed and came back and they won the day. And I really don't remember anything else about that issue, so I'm sure my details are suspect except for Ted using his last spare life. Oh, thanks, Tim. Tim goes on to say about what made him interested in Wildcat. He says it was the Justice Society of America series that you're covering. This made me care about Ted. He's tough, funny, heroic, and a crazy old guy in a cat suit. What's not to love? As for these two miniseries, in spite of how they had elements that kind of leaned into Wildcat's world, they overwhelmingly felt like Batman stories with Wildcat thrown in. And Batman and Wildcat, I could remember all of the villains from the Bat titles except for Ernie Chubb. Then Catwoman Wildcat is a heist gone wrong, just like all of Dixon's Catwoman stories. Just because boxing scenes are included doesn't make it feel Wildcat. Maybe if there had been significant time spent with Ted training or engaging or even saving other boxers, that might have tipped things. Alas, it comes across as trying to add Ted to the Bat family, which isn't a bad thing when the JSA isn't around, but I don't love it either. Then he says, no, I did not read these books back in the day, only just this week before listening to the show. And you know me, I'll take a reading challenge when I can, so I don't regret reading either. Well, that's awesome, Tim. Thank you so much for reading along with the show. I think that's fantastic. And he says, now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go purge the image of Stella calling Ted Daddy from my mind. He says, I kid, that was hilarious. You go, Stella. Oh, that was hysterical. She was a real hoot. All right, then we're from Brett Miller, who says, at the end, when Stella joked that she was 17 years old, it kind of explained her defense of Hal Jordan earlier in the podcast. on to Ted Grant. I love Wildcat, except for the version in Batman Brave and the Bold, where he had those giant white cheeks and the 90-year-old man voice. The idea of a pure fighter as a hero has always appealed to me. Rocky Balboa is a superhero. Anyway, great show as always. Well, thanks, Brett. I appreciate that. All right, then we'll hear from Chris Franklin from the Fire and Water Podcast Network. He has shows such as Mr. and Mrs. Superman, which is right here on the Justice Society Presents feed, and he's currently releasing with his wife The House of Frankenstein. Of course, he does a bunch more beyond that. He says, I have a soft spot for these miniseries because I really enjoyed the Chuck Dixon-led era of the Batman comics, and we had Beau Smith as a guest at the comic shop I worked at during this period. Beau couldn't have been a nicer guy, and he even brought goodies for us at the store, like color proofs of the covers, which I still have. My memory is foggy now, but I do know he was hopeful that he and Dixon would get to do more Wildcat. Oh, Chris, that's great. In fact, there's going to be a little more on that in just a minute. Then we heard from Nate the Great. Says, I always thought Wildcat should have been played by Bruce Campbell. Ted's not quite Stallone, but he does have that old school vibe. I'm not sure if many of the stories hold up, but I really did like Balance Catwoman at the time. This mini was right in the middle of that period. It seems a little dated now. Nate, about your suggestion about Bruce Campbell, that would be a lot of fun. I stumbled across on social media just the other day. I saw someone suggesting that Alan Rickson should play Wildcat. And at first I'm like, come on, this guy's already played Aquaman. He's already played Hawk. Give it a rest. And, you know, he played Reacher as well. But now that I look at pictures of him today, he's a little bit older. He's a little bit beefier. He's a little bit stockier. And he's in his like mid-40s. Actually, guys, Alan Rickson would make a great Ted Grant, like a mid-40s Ted Grant. That would be like an aged boxer. That would be amazing. So just putting that out there in the universe. Then we heard from Paul Hicks, formerly of Waiting for Doom at DCOCD. We had talked about in the last episode the funeral for Yolanda Montez and how they had a picture of her in a bikini on her coffin. And Paul says, judgy, my funeral photo will be me in a bikini. Well, Paul, I think we all completely believe that, so that's fair. Then we heard from Dustin Gibbons, who says he was talking to someone recently about Wildcat on Facebook. They were discussing favorite JSA-JLA team-ups. I answered that mine is a book that, looking back now, I'm sure isn't great, but it was a Batman Brave and the Bold that guest-starred Wildcat. I know that Batman Brave and the Bold books are supposed to take place on their own Earth or whatever, but when I read it, I didn't know that. I just knew the book took place pre-crisis. Anyways, that was my first introduction to Wildcat. I was super confused because I'm like, why is Catwoman a man named why is Catwoman a man named Wildcat? LOL. Then my dad explained, no, that's Wildcat, that he was part of the JSA, just like the Green Lantern who has a cape and Dr. Fate, and how they were heroes when his parents were reading comics when they were younger. He says, I really enjoyed Wildcat being in the Justice League Unlimited cartoon. He had a spotlight episode with the Underground Fight Club. Yeah, Dustin, that Fight Club episode was fantastic. I think Stella mentioned it last time, too. Such a good episode. Then we heard from Noah Tarnow from the Big Quiz Thing, and I Don't Get It, the Pop Culture Get Off My Lawn cast. Noah says, great episode. Wildcat was one of those characters I was fascinated in my very early comics fandom days, back when I was more about looking at the pictures in comics rather than reading them. I think I had some late 1970s All-Star Comics issues and some JLA-JSA team-ups. There's something about his look that walks the line between superhero and real-world guy that piques my interest. It says, Wildcat as a mentor and an old man badass works well for me, so long as it isn't overused. One great moment was in an early issue of the first JSA series when Wildcat's alone in the bath at the headquarters when the Injustice Society invades, and he manages to methodically defeat them all. Yep, there we go. Another mention of JSA number 10. Such a good issue. Noah continues with, I remember the Batman Wildcat miniseries fondly. Not sure I read the Catwoman one, though, and your episode inspired me to reread it for the first time since it came out. It's fun, but damn, those are some extremely late 1990s-style arts. Also, the trope of super criminals being kept in a private prison rubs me the wrong way, since it always has a bunch of elements that take me out of the story. Like, really? KG Beast and King Snake, both who have been shown to be highly intelligent tacticians, are just being held in someone's basement indefinitely without managing to escape? When they're let out, why do they attack Batman instead of lock up an Ernie? Also, who's feeding them? Where do they go to the bathroom? Are they at least given any reading material? All good questions, Noah. All very good questions, and why none of us should ever run our own private prison. Then we heard from Doug Adamson from the Monitor Tapes, a Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast. Doug says, this episode was a great listen. Kudos to Stella for bringing the female gaze to the books in question. We need more of that to help balance out Shag's irredeemable tendencies, which have been a more restrained as the years have gone on, to be fair. Well, thank you, Doug. And yes, Stella was fantastic, and she was an absolute hoot. Then we're from Liz Ann Oswald, who has her own YouTube channel. Liz says, Wildcat's always been a staple of the JSA. My favorite story with Ted was a JSA one before he fought Johnny Sorrow and the other villains with an injury and won, at the same time as flirting with Catwoman. There you go. Once again, the beloved JSA number 10. Then Liz goes on to say, and DC does have Richard Dragon and Lady Shiva and a few others that do train up other heroes. Which is a great point, Liz, because, you know, that's what we're just saying, is Wildcat's trained everyone. But yeah, DC has tried to say that Richard Dragon and Lady Shiva have trained some other folks. So I guess they've got a couple other mentor people out there. Then Liz says, Wildcat's kind of a blue-collar everyman like the Ben Grimm at Marvel. Interesting analogy. Well, thanks, Liz. Then we heard from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. Bucky says that he met Wildcat from Justice League Unlimited. Bucky also says that he really liked to see Wildcat in Batman Brave and the Bold cartoon, acting as a mentor to Batman and the Outsiders. I'm a big fan of the teenage Katana and Metamorpho. And then a little later, Bucky says, Wildcat is cool. I kind of see him as what Green Arrow is now to the common man's hero. Yeah, that's kind of a good analogy. Wildcat is kind of the common man's hero, and that is definitely Green Arrow's role now. So, interesting. Good thought. Then we heard from Dave Tomko from the website called New Earth 2. Dave says, great episode, guys. I really agree with the idea that Wildcat works best as an older character who trains the younger generations. Both Batman Wildcat and Catwoman Wildcat were fun, but very 90s. Then Dave goes on to say, when I first read these stories as a kid, I just saw Ted as a ladies' man. Beyond Selina, he's also been linked with Queen Hippolyta, Irina, which is Jake's mom, Marilyn Brosnan, who's Tom's mom, and probably Lady Blackhawk in those Guy Gardner Warrior issues. Speaking of which, Bo Smith deserves a ton of credit for that run. He managed to make Guy palatable, paving the way for Pete Tomasi to continue that development at Green Lantern Corps. I am right there with you. Bo Smith did an amazing turnaround for Guy Gardner and made that, for me, a book that was a must-read. And I know a lot of people don't like the Vundarian stuff, but if you read the behind the scenes and understand the position that the creative team was put in, where they weren't allowed to use any Green Lantern or Yellow Lantern or any kind of ring stuff like that. They were put in a tough spot. And you know what? The Vondarian stuff, it worked. It worked for what they needed to do. And, you know, they really told some great stories. Now, Dave goes on to share, on the subject of Bo Smith, he was recently on the Word Balloon podcast and mentioned that there was a planned Robin Wildcat miniseries. It would have focused on Tim Drake and Ted Grant's mentor-student dynamic, with Wildcat acting like the bad uncle, like the kind who encourages a little mischief, like sneaking a beer at a family cookout. Over the story, Tim would have picked up Wildcat's grit and street-fighting mentality, and the finale would have had Batman noticing Tim's sharper combat skills as a nod to Wildcat's influence. Sounds like it would have been a blast, but unfortunately, editorial changes killed it. Oh, Dave, that is such a dream miniseries for me. I mean, that creative team doing a Wildcat-Tim Drake miniseries would have been one of my favorites of all time. Well, thank you for sharing that with me. That is awesome to hear. Then Dave says, last thing, you asked if Wildcat's nine lives from Morrison's JLA-JSA crossover are still in continuity. I'd say yes, but Pete Tomasi had him lose the last of those extra lives in JSA Classified. I recently wrote a blog post about this over on the newearth2.com website. Now, he does want to let you folks know there are some spoilers in there for the current JSA series. Then Dave says, while researching, I found some fan-made profiles claiming that Wildcat's nine lives can regenerate. Like, you have to kill him nine times in a row for it to stick. I haven't been able to track down an actual source for that idea, though. If anyone knows where it comes from, please let me know. I'd love to update my post. Well, thank you, Dave. That was an awesome amount of information. Then we heard from Jose Rivera, author of The Underground Adventures. He says, you know how we previously mentioned some of the early elder statesman members of the JSA feel like uncles you've had? Well, Ted Grant is like the uncle you've had when you were a teenager who wouldn't sugarcoat things while teaching you how to defend yourself if need be. That's what I think when I see Wildcat. Jose, I can totally see that. Ted Grant being that the favorite uncle who, like you said, doesn't sugarcoat things. Then Jose goes on to say, even in these two miniseries, I love that he's both a mentor and an equal to Batman and Catwoman. And he says, one thing I do want to mention, and I know it's a preference thing, do you prefer Wildcat with taped fists or without them? For me, it depends on the situation. He can hold his own normally, but I feel that if you're in a fight with Wildcat and he suddenly tapes up his fist, you know you're messed up at that point. Jose, for me, I guess I didn't really think about it until a few months back. I actually like the tape wrists. I think it looks really cool. I think it reemphasizes him as a boxer. There's a lot of people that don't like it. I think it looks great. I definitely prefer the tape wrist nowadays. So that's just me. All right, then we hear from Peter Watson, my buddy from the Earth 2 podcast. Peter has decided to take me to task because I said that I do not believe in an Earth 1 Wildcat. I'm going to read most of this, but there's a lot here, but we're going to go through it. It's fun. He yells at me, Shag, will you say you don't believe there's an Earth 1 Wildcat? Allow me to present the evidence for the defense. Exhibit A, Wildcat teams up with a Batman in the Brave and the Bold's number 88, 97, 110, 118, and 127. These stories have a contemporary 1970s setting, a time when the Earth 2 Batman was mostly semi-retired and rarely seen. Batman is shown to be in his familiar yellow oval logo, which is worn by the Earth 1 version. There's no mention of a multiversal travel in any of these stories. Exhibit B, Wildcat teams up with a Creeper in Super Team Family number 2. The Creeper was established as an Earth 1 character, not seen on any other Earths, and again, there's no mention of multiversal travel in this story. Exhibit C, in the above stories, Ted Grant has an established life and is well known on Earth 1. Exhibit D, at no point in Earth 2 Wildcat's appearances in the late 70s All-Star Comics and Adventure Comics does he mention his recent team-ups with either Batman or the Creeper. If I met the Creeper, a counterpart of a, quote, friend from work, I'd certainly be talking about it. Exhibit E, Wildcat's origin from Sensation Comics number 1 shows that his inspiration for taking up a costume identity was from a kid who'd been reading a Green Lantern comic. We know from such stories as Showcase number 4 and Flash 268 that a lot of the adventures of Earth 2 characters were published in comics on Earth 1. In a way, it makes more sense for there to be an Earth 1 version of Wildcat than an Earth 2 version. And now the evidence for the prosecution. He covers his eyes, points fingers in his ears, and says, these stories must have taken place on Earth B, where all the wacky Bob Haney, Murray Boltonoff stories are set. End evidence for the prosecution. Yeah, he says, Earth B is a lazy catch-all term to give the Haney-Boltonoff stories a free pass when it comes to continuity. However, the majority of these stories easily fit within the continuity of the Earth 1 Batman. Therefore, this court finds that there is an Earth 1 Wildcat, and Shag is sentenced to listen to the Earth 2 podcast for the episodes that covered these stories. Well, first, Peter, I don't need to be sentenced to listen to the Earth 2 podcast, because the Earth 2 podcast is fantastic. But your evidence all holds up. I'm totally with you. However, there's this little piece of me that that just says the writers didn't care about continuity. It's not that there's an Earth B or something like that. The writers just simply didn't care. Like, they wanted to tell a Batman and Wildcat story, so that's what they did. Who cares about continuity? So I still argue there is no Earth 1 Wildcat, the same way I say there's no Earth 2 Aquaman. It's just a matter of the writer wanted to tell a story the way the writer wanted to tell it. Who cares about continuity at that point? So that's where I'm going to come down, but you made a very good logical argument that I am choosing to, as you said, stick my fingers in my ears and ignore. Thank you, Peter. I appreciate you writing in. Then we're from Diablo Frank on the World Spine Podcasting Network. He also does the DC Seeker Files podcast, and he's my co-host on the Blue Devil episodes of Once Upon a Geek. Now, he's cheering a lot of information, as Frank always does, but I'm going to read some of it. He says, there are a couple of Seeker Files entries for Ted Grant, both by art by Sergio Carello, which is great because Sergio is the one who did the art in the miniseries. So that's cool to know. Thanks, Frank. And he says, he starts talking about where did he start to make Ted Grant's acquaintance? Well, it would have been Zero Hour and Guy Gardner Warrior. He was a regular at the Warrior's Bar, and I got invested enough in the Mitch Bird drawn issues in the run-up to Zero Hour that I hung around until the bitter end. Once again, those Beau Smith issues of Guy Gardner Warrior are so stinking good. Then Frank says, I don't recall Wildcat ingratiating me exceptionally at that time. I know I read the Batman Wildcat miniseries, but I don't remember much about it, including any strong feelings about it either way. I also know that I bought the Catwoman Wildcat miniseries the following year, and I remember even less about that, and yet still feel more positively disposed to it. He then goes on to say some things, which clearly tells me Frank didn't bother to listen to the episode, which is fine. Then he writes, at a glance, I've never read a great Wildcat story. There's being some solo spotlight stuff, but mostly I see him in a team setting. Wasn't there a JSA issue where he, here it is, JSA number 10 again, wasn't there a JSA issue where he alone had to defend the base against intruders and took a daredevil style walloping? That was pretty cool. I don't see a potential in Wildcat as a solo star. He's seasoned, the good-hearted but sometimes problematic old bruiser who'll show you the ropes and maybe pull a Bill Belichick. Oh, wow. I don't know whether you're making a football reference there or you're making a reference to Robin the Cradle. I'm going to go with Robin the Cradle, but anyway. Regardless of the age difference and the mentor-mentee history, there is no universe where Selina Kyle is not the dominant figure in a consensual relationship. His only other play pal that I know of is Hippolyta, and that's one hell of an age difference in the other direction. You know, that's a great point. You know, Hippolyta was significantly older than Ted. He says, I adore Wildcat's ridiculous costume, which helped his Golden Age stories look so much wilder and more dynamic than most anything else DC was putting out at the time. I love it when he has toenails and his custom cat-themed motorcycle. He's kind of like what might have happened if Ben Grimm didn't make it to college, except Ted is clearly way kinkier and more overall game than Ben. Look at that, a second reference to Ben Grimm comparing him to Wildcat. That's interesting. All right. I don't recall if it was mentioned on the show, which is code for I didn't listen. But anyway, Frank says, I don't recall if it was mentioned on the show, but just in case, Mindy Newell had Ted Grant train Selina Kyle in the 1989 Catwoman miniseries. Well, there we go. That's kind of interesting. We assumed that it came out here in that Wildcat Catwoman miniseries, but to hear that it actually came out in the 1989 Catwoman miniseries, that's great information. Thank you, Frank. Then we heard from Brett Young from the Firewater Podcast Network. He hosts a show called Fantastic Poor, or as the cool kids call it, The Poor. Brett says, great rundown of Wildcat, guys. He's an interesting guy. No weapons or powers, just a tough guy dressed like a cat with taped up knuckles. But it works. And despite being around magicians and speedsters and ultra-powerful ring wielders, Wildcat is a core member of the JSA moving forward. I would say if you're a fan of Ted Grant, do not read the Tom King Black Canary miniseries. He's treated as a dim-witted tomato can goon who routinely gets whumped by whoever he faces. Yikes. Well, thank you for the warning, Brett. I appreciate that. Then we heard from Matt Ludwick, who says, there is a version of Wildcat that came out earlier than the one in DC Comics. The pulp novels of the Whisperer, aka Police Commissioner James Wildcat Gordon. So this threw me for a loop. I had to look this up. Thank you, Matt. So yes, legitimately, from 1936 to 1940, there was a pulp character called the Whisperer, and he was a police commissioner, and his name really was James Gordon. So according to, you know, Wikipedia, which is always right, of course, it says in Detective Comics number 27, he was just called Commissioner Gordon, and later on he was given the name Jim that they borrowed specifically from the Whisperer. That's insane! I've never heard that before. That's crazy. All right, then Uncle Bruno Diaz, who does a whole bunch of custom action figures, he posted an image of an amazing image with a Wildcat action figure and custom figures of Sportsmaster, Tigress, and Yellow Wasp. That looked awesome, Uncle Bruno. Thank you for sharing. Then John Stibe was kind enough to promote our show. He goes, one of my earliest memories of Wildcat is from the Justice League of America number 147. I couldn't figure out why Batman's ears were floppy and why he had a Brooklyn accent. Ted Grant has been a favorite of mine ever since. Check out this podcast to see what's Wildcat doing in the 90s. Well, thank you, John. Chris Moore says, listening to this now, was never a Wildcat fan, but Shag's enthusiasm has me wanting to seek out some back issues. Well, I hope you did, Chris. Court Johnson says, I've started listening to their other JSA in the 90s and their Sandman Mystery Theater podcast, and I'm really enjoying them. Well, awesome, Court. I'm glad to hear you're enjoying the show. Kurt Matilla says, great episode. I'm a huge Ted Grant fan, and I've never heard of these two miniseries. I took a comic book hiatus during the 1990s, but thought I was caught up on what I missed. Clearly not. Thank you, Shag and Stella. Well, hope you find these miniseries, Kurt, and enjoy them. Then we'll hear from Andrew, redheaded fanboy, says he was inspired by JSA Presents to finish both Batman Wildcat and Catwoman Wildcat miniseries. Hope you liked them, Andrew. Then Lito Sandoval says, this is probably my favorite comic podcast, and they focus on two of my favorites recently, The Spectre and Wildcat. Aw, Lito, that was so incredibly kind of you to say. We really appreciate that. All right, folks, now this is the part of the show where I thank everyone who shared Justice Society Presents JSA in the 90s on their social media timeline. So we're talking Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, and Threads. Yes, it is a long list of names. I am aware. However, these folks showed their support and promoted the show, so it's important to me that we recognize these individuals. For example, this is the only time that Clinton Robinson's probably going to get mentioned on the show, but he's still part of our family, so he deserves to be mentioned. Now, this time out, we got over 80 names of people who helped promote the show recently, which is fantastic. So you could be on this list next month. All you have to do is share or retweet or whatever the heck it's called on the other platforms. So again, Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, or Threads. Our thanks go out to Alan Williams. I got it right this time, didn't I, Alan? Alan Boyce Jr., Andre Friedis, Andrew Redheaded Fanboy, Barry Reese's Infinity Ink Tumblr, Benjamin Hall, Between the Pages Blog, Bill Beer and his account for The Batpod, Billy D and his account for A World on Fire and All-Star Squadron Podcast, Black Vulcan 69, Brad Dade, Brett Young, Brian Schufo, Chris Franklin, Chris Helgerson, Chris Leiden, Chris Mort, Clinton Robinson, Codex Omniversa, Craig McD, D. Kennedy at Detective 38, Dan Dougherty, Dave Tomko and his DC New Earth 2 account, Dave's Comic Heroes blog, David Ace Gutierrez, Dave Steele in the Earth 2 podcast, Derek Crabb, Diablo Frank and his Rolled Spines podcast, Ed Moore, Eddie Schmitz, Eric Shee, Extremely Uncanny, Gentleman Joey, Grumpy Old John, Jaime Valdez Lopez, Jamerson Tiasi, Joe Tonello, John Stibe, Justice Trek, Justin Steiner, Keechy Baker, Court Johnson, Lito Sandoval, Lizanne Oswald, Martin Gray, Matthew Barton, Max Romero, Mo Walker, Movie Matt Royce, Nuno Duarte, The Only American Captain Britain Fan, Paul Kean, Pop Culture Basement Podcast, Prairie Justice, the Greg Saunders Vigilante Podcast, Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Resurrections, and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Richard Field, Rob Kelly, Robert Junker, Ryan Daly, S. Matthew Stolte, Scott X, Sean Ross and his Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman Podcast, Silverman on Security, Stella at Batgirl to Oracle, Stephen E. Shend, Symbol Pending, Teal Productions, Tim Price and the Outcasters, a Batman and the Outsiders Podcast, Trent Lewis, Venkman, Watch This Space, Zeb Oswalt, and Zek Cap Boots. Whew. Well, thank you so much to all of you for your support of the JSA and the 90s podcast. Your feedback is such a critical part of the show, and this community of JSA fans we're building together are fantastic. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Stella from last episode. I do my best to find all your social media comments, but sometimes they do slip through my internet fingers. So, folks, please keep those cards and letters coming. Remember, our website is where the majority of the conversation is happening, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JSA. Leave your comments on the show post, and fellow JSA fans can share their thoughts, and you guys can communicate with each other. You can also find us on most social media platforms as JSA Presents, including Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, Twitter or X, and Threads, or you can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. My thanks again to you listeners for such a great collection of feedback. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll connect with this episode's guest, Devin Clancy, and see if he's managed to wrangle Guy Gardner.
Transmitter device activated. Coordinates set for Earth 2. In 1961, in the pages of issue 123 of The Flash, Barry Allen, the Silver Age Flash of Earth 1, travelled to another dimension, met Jay Garrick, the Golden Age Flash of Earth 2, and the DC Multiverse as we know it was born.
And in 1985, after many years of cross-dimensional adventures, DC Comics published the cataclysmic Crisis on Infinite Earths, and the DC Multiverse was gone.
But did you know that Barry Allen's Flash was not the first hero to meet a version of himself from another dimension?
Did you know that Jay Garrick wasn't even the first Golden Age character to return in the Silver Age of comics?
The scope of the pre-crisis DC Multiverse reaches far beyond Earth 1 and Earth 2.
And the legacy of DC's Golden Age characters is a lot wider than the heroes you know like Flash, Green Lantern, Sandman and Starman.
On the Earth 2 podcast, we navigate the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse of universes and other dimensions.
And we celebrate and explore the legacy of DC's Golden Age characters, including the legendary Justice Society of America, and a lot more besides.
So join me, Peter Watson.
And me, David Steele, and our occasional guests of friends, family and fellow podcasters.
For weekly dramatic readings and analysis of the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse and the legacy of their Golden Age characters through the Silver and Bronze Ages of comics.
On
the Earth 2 podcast.
Transmatter Cube activated. Return coordinates set for Earth Prime.
Batman Nightcast is back with new episodes every month.
This time, we're covering the Dark Knight stories we overlooked in previous iterations of this show.
Anyway, I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Join us as we find our joy with Batman Comics chronicling the Caped Crusader's first adventures with the Boy Wonder.
Thrill as we review the fiendish plots of a who's who of villains, like Poison Ivy, Killer Croc, Gentleman Ghost, and Clayface 3.
If this is a bit, I don't understand it.
Hey kids, comics by legendary creators Don Newton, Neil Adams, Marshall Rogers, and Bill Sienkiewicz.
Plus, the single greatest Batman story ever told.
It all comes back to Batman Nightcast.
I don't know what's happening right now.
New episodes every month.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
Wanna make something of it?
Did you fall on your head?
All right, folks, we're back from break, and yes, we've got Devin back with us. Now, Devin, thank you so much for appearing in this episode. It's been far too long since we chatted. This was an absolute blast. I always love chatting with you, man. Thank you so much for being here. Now, why don't you tell the listeners where they can find a little more of you on the internets and what you might be up to?
Well, as you know, I don't really have a podcast. You just put me on here because I paid you. But you know, I'm workshopping a few ideas of my own, so maybe you know, you're the expert. You tell me what you think. My first idea is JSA in the 50s. It's just 9 issues of All-Star Comics, and then we're done. Or, hear me out, JSA in the 30s, which is even easier. That, they didn't come out until 1940.
And I'm looking forward to your episode all about the HUAC committee.
Yeah, so I'm giving you this one for free. This is a fantastic idea. You start JSA in the 30s, and you know, obviously you establish the brand. Yeah. And then 5 years from now, when they're publishing actual JSA comics in the 2030s, you're right there. You're on board already.
So it is a perfect setup.
Yeah, I'm going to let you keep that one.
Thank you.
Second idea is Tangent Comics Cast. Mm. Tangent Comics Cast. We're not going to talk about the Tangent Universe 5th week event. We're just going to start talking about a comic and then shift into like a totally different topic and, you know, talk about, I don't know, flowers or cats or politics or whatever.
Or like role-playing like we did this episode?
Of course, yes. Yep. I mean, it always happens. It's inevitable.
Okay.
And then another idea is Who's Who Review. I'm going to play random clips from your clip show, and I'm going to do a clip show about them. I'm going to tell you, you know, maybe what you did right, maybe what you did wrong.
Oh my gosh, I love all of these ideas.
I got a lot of them, but you know, I'm just going to give you 3 for now because you know, once you throw it out there, then somebody copies you, and then you know.
Oh right, no, totally. You got to safeguard your intellectual property without a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
I got to tell you, Who's Who Review that could happen once Rob and I run out of Who's Who Review. I mean, because we're not going to let that show go. So you may be onto something there. So I appreciate it, Devin.
We're still waiting for The Fly and those other ones, those other guys from what is it?
Impact.
Impact. Yeah, yeah. We're waiting for those.
I tell you, I mean, we have had a plan since almost the beginning. So that goes back, oh my gosh, to 2012. So however long that, 13 years ago. We've had a plan since almost the beginning how to cover those Impact comics. So we know how to do it. It's just now it's become such a thing. It's like, you know what? Let's make them wait a little longer.
Let's wait till the 50th anniversary of Impact Comics because people will be anxiously awaiting that.
There we go. We could do that. Well, thank you again, Devin. I sincerely appreciate it. This has been an absolute blast, man.
This is fun. It's one of my top five favorite podcasts for sure. So I was really happy to be on here.
Aw, well, thank you. I don't think that's a slight. It sounds like a compliment. I'm just going to take it as a compliment and run with it. That's fine. There we go. Okay.
I'm not going to tell you what's ahead or behind or whatever. It's in the top five. That's really
well, I good. Just meant you might only listen to five is what I'm saying. So
at least seven or eight.
Okay. Well, okay. On the percentage side, I guess I'm doing okay.
I'll give you top four.
Thank you, Devin. I appreciate it. Well, that is going to do it, folks. Now, come back next episode when we cover Justice Society of America number 10, the final issue in this run. Now, it's certainly not the end of our JSA in the 90s coverage because we've still got the 8-issue series from 1991, that miniseries to discuss, plus a whole bunch more spotlight episodes. So next episode, I will be joined by another fantastic guest to help me cover the issue. Who's it going to be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Devin.
And we're asking you to join the fight
for justice.